Like to call this meeting of House State Affairs together. It's 8:07 on Tuesday, January 10th. And present are Representative Elkins, Representative Ramirez, Representative Gruenberg, Representative Lynn, Representative Gatto has an excused absence, and I'm Chair Seaton. Today we have three orders of business before us, three bills, HB 23, construction of Legislative Hall, HB 278, retirement system bonds, and HB 273, PFD, delay permanent fund for allowable absence. And we've been joined by Representative Gardner. And we intend to take testimony and presentation on those issues if we get to 273. We do not plan to move any of those pieces of legislation today. And just so everybody's noticed, we will be taking up those pieces of legislation next week as well. So stay tuned. We do not have the sponsor of HB 23 here yet, so we will start. We have another representative who came in to give us some testimony, so we'll start with his testimony on the bill. We've heard HB 23 before. There is a committee substitute in your packet, and we will start with Representative Newman. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Seaton. Today I'd just like to talk to the committee a little bit about an option that my community has come up with for a legislative hall. In discussions that I've had with Matsuburo, the manager of the Matsuburo, John Duffy, last spring, we have identified 1,000 acres out in the Point McKenzie area. There's a couple of nice lakes on it, nice wooded areas. And the proposal that we would like to put forth at this time would be to give any developer the development rights to that 1,000 acres and that 1,000 acres plus the development rights for the construction of a legislative hall on there. I envision shopping centers, some nice housing there, hotels, motels, the works that can be built around this area. This is one of the fastest growing areas in the state. I think this would be a great option where we could put something out there for a legislative hall in the major areas of population of the state, where it would serve at least 60% locally, and over 75% of the state, I believe, on the road system would have access within just several hours of a legislative hall. And I'm not talking about moving the Capitol or anything like that. This would just be a legislative hall where the legislative body would meet for our 100-day or 90-day sessions, as the case may be. And I think that it's a good option where it doesn't cost the state a lot of money. I have submitted this idea to several developers in the area, and I'm waiting for some feedback on that, and I'll certainly keep the committee up to date as to what's going on in that area. There is a fast ferry service that's going to be started next year. So even if the Kinnickarn Bridge does not get completed or if it is delayed for any reason, there will still be access from the airport, which was part of the bill, that it has to have access to an airport. It would be, I think it would just be so much easier for a lot of the Alaska residences that have to come from Nome. They can fly into Anchorage, take a shuttle over to the legislative hall, get back over to the airport, and get their way back home. I think it would save a lot of money for the citizens of Alaska. The majority of the citizens, of course, the people in Southeast may have to do the same journey that we're doing right now. But I think, again, it would serve the major areas of population in the state quite well. Any questions that I can answer from the committee?
Thank you, Representative Newman. I appreciate you coming here and talking on this. Before we go further, we do have a CS that's been submitted by the sponsor. Can I have a motion for bringing that forward for discussion?
Sure. I move CS for House Bill 23 for purposes of discussion.
Thank you, Representative Lynn. Representative Newman, I guess I had a first question, and that is that the proposal we have here is that the Legislative Council would come up with specifications for a legislative hall, a number of items. Is the suggestion that you're having that the developer would work within the specifications that is created by Ledge Council within those development rights?
Mr. Chair, that would be correct. Of course, anything that the developer works on would have to work through what Ledge Hall or Ledge Council works with, but I think that it would assist Ledge Council tremendously to have a developer there to help them work through this process, and maybe they can save a little bit of money that way, save a little bit of time, and be more efficient in the process.
Sure, thank you. And Representative Lynn has a question.
Yes, I don't recall. I know there's a small light playing field over on Park McKenzie. I've landed from the Aero Club over there from time to time. It's a dirt strip. I don't recall how close that is to the anticipated terminus of the proposed Kinnear-Connor Bridge on the north side, which could be used. Are you familiar with the airport I'm talking about?
Through the chair, Representative Lindley, yes, I am.
Is that the Goose Bay?
I believe that's, through the chair, I believe that's a private strip out there, but there is plans for development plans out there for a commercial airstrip for commercial airbase. Also, I may add that natural gas does run through the area. They do have electricity through the area. The area has all been platted, so there is roads platted and access out to the area as it stands right now.
And if I may, just a couple more quick ones.
Representative Lynn.
I'm not sure on the CS, but in the original bill, there's a requirement limiting boroughs or unified municipalities to at least 30,000 residents. We'd have to put an amendment to change that, I suppose, because there's certainly not 30,000 residents over on that side at this time.
Through the chair, Representative Lynn, it would be through the municipality of the Matsu Borough.
Okay, and then the last question for now, at least. As we know, there's a tremendous housing problem for legislators and staffs and families and so on down at the present location of our legislative facilities here in Juneau. And I'm wondering if any consideration been made for some kind of legislative slash staff housing, perhaps a dormitory hall on the site or close to the legislative hall, because that's a tremendous problem for all of us.
Through the chair, Representative Lynn, I would envision that a developer would certainly have to include some type of housing units for the people there that work through in the legislative body, which would include some type of housing. Of course, we do have Anchorage within a half hour of the area, which, you know, until that gets developed up around there. And if this hall does get constructed, it will take time for it to grow and develop around there. But we have to look beyond just the certain building itself. And I think that the legislative hall in itself would attract a need for that. And again, with the fast ferry service that's going to be started next year, even if the bridge isn't constructed, there is access into the Anchorage Bowl right now.
And just one quick.
Representative Lynn, follow up.
I was actually, I agree with you, but I was actually thinking of an annex to the dormitory hall itself, leased out by the state at an appropriate price. A building owned by the state rather than a private developer. Not that I'm opposed to private development, but if that could be in the things we might consider.
I would just like to go back and clarify that we're not having a hearing on a specific proposal right now. It is, it's appropriate. It's interesting that you're coming forward and showing that there is some interest from an area to bid on a legislative hall. But this is not.
Well, I just wanted to interject,
no,
Mr. Chair.
And that's fine.
That thought and not making a proposal itself.
That's fine. But I want to clarify for the audience and the listening audience that we are not having a hearing on a specific legislative hall in Matsu, that Matsu, through Representative Newman, is coming forward and saying that they would be interested in offering a bid, a competitive bid, on a legislative hall in a particular area. But the subject of the hearing is whether we want to consider going out under this bill to allow different municipalities and boroughs to bid at the maximum rate of $1 a year to furnish a legislative hall for the for the legislature to meet. So I just wanted to make that clear to the audience.
And Mr. Chair, the idea of the dormitory was not tied specifically to any place in the metro. It could be anywhere you would build such a hall within the state. Thank
That's
you.
Fine. Thank you. And Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify a little bit of that also, I'm sure working any developer or ledge council could work through that, you know, as the specifics, as the chair stated. Also, again, this is a plan that was put forth with discussions with myself and the Mat-Su Borough to donate the land, the 1,000 acres, and the development rights to that, to the developer that would like to build a hall, which would cost the state of Alaska virtually nothing for the construction of this building.
Thank you. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Newman, thank you. I was pleased to hear that the economic engine in the Mat-Su and the Rail Belt, in your opinion, is cranking right along at a real good speed. When you talk about taking an economic engine away from Juneau, a major economic engine, it has a major impact on all the Southeastern. And this engine, economic engine for Juneau, is huge and has a major impact on Ketchikan and other communities down here. I think it's totally inappropriate for this body to consider like taking economic sanctions against another community when their economies are all cranking and doing very well. And just by the nod of new students coming in to your area every year is an indication that things are moving very good, and I'm very pleased to have you hear that. But I think personally it's totally wrong for this body to consider
Representative Elkins,
any other agent.
Could I ask you to hold that for a moment and address that to the sponsor? Right now we just have Representative Newman, who was here just indicating that they would desire. So I think that if you wouldn't mind addressing that with the sponsor, I'd sure appreciate it.
Mr. Chair?
Are there any other questions for Representative Newman? Yes, Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If the members would turn in the CS to page 5, section 6 repeals the Frank Initiative. That's something new in this bill. And I'm going to ask my staff to copy that so we can distribute it.
Representative Grunberg,
I have a question.
Is that going to be for the sponsor of the bill or
no.
For the Representative Newman?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Representative Newman, do you favor the repeal of the Frank Initiative?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I am not fully versed on all the phases. I haven't had a chance to look at the CS, so I'd like to withhold a response on that right now. But, Mr. Chair, if I could make a quick response to Representative Elkins, I'd like to do that.
Mr. Chair, before he does, at some point I would like to know your position on my question.
Certainly, I'd be, through the chair, I'd be glad to
Representative Newman.
Through the chair, Representative Elkins, I do understand your concerns about the loss of the economic engines of the legislative body meeting in Juneau, but I would also like to consider you to consider the fact that this is a 120 or possibly a 90-day unit, and I'm not talking about moving the Capitol and all the state buildings and offices that do go along with this that provide the full-time jobs here in the community. Also, I would like you to keep in mind that I believe that it is a major calling by the majority of the state of Alaska to have access to their legislators while they're in the legislative session, so that school kids could come, more hundreds and thousands of school kids could come and watch the process and see how bills are introduced, legislation debated, and bills become law. And I think that that's an important part of trying to get more people to get out and vote and to access the legislative body to the majority of the people. But I do recognize your concerns, sir.
Are there any other questions for Representative Newman before we move to the sponsor of the legislation and deal with the legislation? Thank you very much for coming. I appreciate
you
being able to come join us early. I would like to also recognize that we've been joined by Representative Kelly. And if you would like to join us up at the front, you may. And we've been joined by Representative Roachberg. Representative Roachberg, thank you. And as you heard, we just had a little discussion about one area that says they would be interested in entertaining your proposal.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize. It was one of those mornings where if anything can go wrong, it did. And it did. And I'm tardy. And I want to thank Representative Newman for sitting in and presenting his testimony so not to lose any more time for the committee. You have already adopted the CS. If you'd like me to briefly go through that and also respond to some questions, I'd be happy to do that. We've had a hearing on this legislation before, so I don't think it's necessary to rehash it unless anybody has any questions about that. So whatever you wish to me to testify to, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to do so.
Thank you. I'd appreciate it. It is a new CS. There are some changes, and also it's been quite a while since we had our hearing. So a refresher for the committee would be helpful.
Right. Mr. Chairman, the if you have in your packet, you should have a sectional analysis of the committee substitute for House Bill 23, State Affairs now. Section 2 merely changes the date to develop the specs to 2006. Most of these are ministerial changes. In addition, it also changes the term from the Uniform Building Code to the International Building Code, which is a technical name change of the organization. Section 3 changes the delivery date to June 30th, 2009. And Section 4, the alleged council is to accept proposals by June 30th, 2007. Section 5, as Representative Greenberg points out, does repeal the provisions of the Frank Initiative, which is 4406, 050, 055, and 060. Those provisions of statute now known as the Frank Initiative are intended to inform the public of the in advance of all costs of relocating the Capitol or the legislature. And Mr. Chairman, the reason I added that provision of repealing it in order to, in a more timely manner, proceed with the activities of the legislature and legislative council on this, it's going to be extremely difficult to try to meet those particular requirements. Number one, before, it's like the cart before the horse. The way my bill is designed, the legislature will only pay $1 a year rent. Therefore, you could make the case that that's the cost. However, there is obviously will be certain relocation costs, depending on where the final selection site would be. And there would be some other relatively modest costs related to that. And by modest, I'm talking several million dollars, but in the seven-digit area, probably. In other words, no more than somewhat less than $10 million at the maximum. And obviously, too, the provisions of the terms of the lease to be entered into between the winning bidder and the legislature would be for the operation and maintenance of that particular structure. That has yet to be, certainly yet to be determined. That would be an ongoing cost. But I think would be more or less repetitive of what the costs are for this building, for example. Then we'd have to look at the whatever the disposition of this building is. So that was, so in other words, I believe that the Frank Initiative is not necessary under the terms of my arrangement here. And I would make a couple of comments about that also editorially. The Frank Initiative was designed by the citizens of this fair city to protect their position as holding onto the Capitol. And the Attorney General found that the requirements of the initiative, that all bondable costs be part of the cost of either relocating the Capitol or the legislature. And looking back at the history of that, Mr. Chairman, the figure that came out in one election, get my history together here. In 1982, the voters rejected the bond ballot proposition to relocate the Capitol to Willow after the Frank initiative had been adopted, and the estimate for the total cost of doing so was, in 1982 was $2,843,000,000. $2.8 billion to relocate the Capitol. I mean, that's absolutely absurd. And naturally, the people of the state objected to the amount because they, being prudent, as all Alaskans are in terms of our public treasury, didn't want to have to expend that kind of money, which is, but on the face of it, it accomplished its intended effect. Because let me just give you a little bit. As my background, I've spent 25 to 30 years as a commercial real estate broker. I was involved with the development of the most major high-rise, mid-rise buildings in Anchorage, Alaska in the 80s, 70s, and 80s, and including the Atwood building now by my client, N.B. Bunker Hunt. I made the mistake of having as a client the richest man in the world who went bankrupt on me. Then I became a public servant. A wonderful transition. But nevertheless, I have a pretty strong background in commercial real estate development. It's always been my contention, as Representative Newman has pointed out, that the whole construction of a new capital even could be accomplished for little or no cost to the state, because private sector real estate developers would lust after the chance to build a new capital building, and I believe more successfully than the Brazilians did a number of years ago. But nevertheless, and at absolutely relatively no cost because of the exchange of land and so forth. But also, having been intimately involved in the Atwood Building's construction and development, and knowing that it's it's like 285,000 square feet of space in that 20-story building that's on three lots in downtown Anchorage, there's a plaza adjacent to the building in the block that's part of the design of the building, and was designed to add five more stories onto the structure. And that could be done for, I'd say, anywhere in the range of $25 to $35 million right now. And a legislative chamber's portion could have been added there and make the whole building a new Capitol building. Now, I'm not advocating that, but I'm suggesting that the cost of doing that would be somewhat under $35 million, not $2.8 billion. Of course, I think that there were some reparations to the economic impacts of Juneau in those numbers. So nevertheless, that's why, in the main, I wanted to repeal that. And it's very important. I want to respond to Representative Elkins' comments and questions to Representative Newman about the impacts on Juneau. And I want to respond and make this clear to the people of the city of Juneau, is I believe in my heart of hearts that the only way we're going to get a new Capitol building, and I strongly advocate that, is to have this type of competition from throughout the state on a level playing field, that everybody has a chance to make a proposal. That includes Juneau. I thoroughly believe, number one, with the assumption that we need a new Capitol building, and so I strongly advocate, that building could be in this community. I believe the people of this community would have the leg up, frankly, of the recent work they've done and so forth. I think they had a very good chance of winning that proposal. They've been reluctant to agree to the financing arrangements under this legislation. They want the legislature to pay for their new Capitol building. That's the distinction here. I think that they need to make the commitment to the legislature, if they want to have a legislature here, is to pay for that building themselves, not expect us to pay the bonding rent to amortize the debt on a new structure. That's the distinction. So the folks here in Juneau need to get off their money and prove to the people of the rest of the state that they deserve to have this legislature here. That's the issue. And that's why I'm asking that the Franken issue be repealed, because it's frankly intellectually dishonest the way it's been used in the past to scare the people of the state.
Thank you, Representative Roper. Representative Gardner, and then Representative Elkins.
Yeah, Representative Roper, through the chair, if memory serves, the there was an attempt to repeal the Frank Initiative. It was on the ballot proposition in 2002, and it failed. Does that not give us pause for repealing it legislatively?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, that's a very good question, and I think on the face of it, it would. But if you analyze the folks that were behind that initiative and what they did politically, there's a gentleman, Ubi Kalinka, in Anchorage, somewhat of a political gadfly, who I think inadvisedly offered the initiative and got the signatures, but then he dropped the ball. He stepped away from it, and he actually quit and conceded defeat over a month before the election. It's because the last committee here in Juneau, and should be expected, had developed a very large war chest to fight the initiative. And Mr. Kalinka did nothing. And it failed of its own weight in a campaign. And he actually came out and stated to that effect, as I recall, several weeks before the election, that he wasn't going to pursue it. And that's why it failed, in my opinion.
But nevertheless, in a
public... Representative Gardner?
Thank you. In a public vote, it did fail.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Elkins?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Roper, you know, if do you really believe that if we just move the legislature, that would be it? I mean, there's lots of support agencies here. It would be way more than just the legislature. I mean, in essence, it would trickle down to moving the whole Capitol. And if you remember back in the Sheffield administration, he moved 200 jobs to Anchorage, and it crippled this town for a number of years. They've just, in the last few years, recovered from that real estate-wise, as you were talking about real estate. But we felt some of that impact in Ketchikan. That's what I can tell you. I mean, the loss of that economy here. And that's my whole point on this thing.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Roper.
Representative Elkin. I tend to disagree with that analysis. Number one, Anchorage is, I think, historically, or for at least the last several decades, had more state employees headcount-wise than Juneau has. Almost every agency has a large amount of their staff. All the commissioners have offices. The governor has offices. You could make the fact that we have a dual capital situation right now. Have a duality of it between Anchorage and Juneau in terms of personnel. Now, in terms of analyzing the historic impacts of things, frankly, I question the economic ripple effect of Juneau on Ketchikan. It's clear to me that the environmental lobbies and the impacts of the closure of the Tongass National Forest to timber and lumbering and the closure of the Ketchikan pulp mill and the mill in Sitka, which in a part were encouraged by many a portion of the population of this community, has had the impacts, the negative impacts of the southeastern economy. To say nothing of the, when I was a member of the legislature, recall vividly the impacts of the shutdown of the attempted restart of the AJ mine here, which in the large part was because of environmental requirements. They were just too stringent and too costly. So I don't have a lot of, from a purely economic analytic standpoint, I find it questionable that the blaming of that has had the impact. I would be the first to admit, however, that there, if in fact the legislative hall were, the legislature were to move out of Juneau, it would have a negative impact. I would agree with that. That's one reason I wanted to pursue just the legislative activities, not the entire Capitol building. I mean, excuse me, the entire executive branch and the Capitol from the community. And there's been a lot of ideas. I mean, I've lived in Alaska all my life, and this has been the ongoing debate. Matter of fact, I think I provided in your packets the letter here, handwritten letter from, oh gosh, from the director of the Bureau of Education, written to a United States senator. I get the date here.
Line in the
map. Oh, yeah. May 3rd, 1890. The day of the letter, saying that he was most disappointed, the gentleman, Lyman Knapp, who was, may have been governor, saying that he thought, from the discussions of relocating the Capitol from Sitka, that Juneau would be a terrible place to have. And this is from 1890. It's kind of interesting. He was writing to a senator in charge of the committee in Washington about the territory of Alaska, that because of the weather conditions, the inability, the lack of access, all the same arguments, lack of ground, and all the same arguments we have today. Anyway, that, I believe, just to try to wrap up that argument about impact, is I think Juneau perhaps would win. What we're not going to do is build a Capitol building here and have it paid for by all the citizens of the states when in the main. My own polling data and my conversations with people for decades is that they'd rather have the Capitol closer to the population of the state. And it's unfortunate we've had this protracted issue before us for so long and without resolution, because we definitely need a new Capitol building. It was one reason I voted against even the remodel on the chamber. Not the fact is that we spent $750,000 on a badly designed, ineffective remodeling in both chambers, and I'm not at all happy.
Well, and Representative Roper, I noticed you did give us a list of a number of the items that are below standard in our current legislative environment. And I would note that there was quite a significant impact last year, I believe, when the Marine Highway System moved a very large number of jobs out of Juneau. We had a number of hearings on that. But of course, I mean, they went to Ketchikan. And so impacts do occur when we make changes. And nobody should underestimate the effects of those changes. And but I think that, you know, we always need to look at the public policy of what we're doing and what those impacts will be. So Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to attack another aspect of this whole discussion.
I hope you don't mean you're going to attack the...
No, in the sense of exploring it.
Yes.
This committee substitute contains one provision that troubles me from a different point of view, regardless of the merits of refurbishing the Capitol. And I totally agree with you that this Capitol building, in many respects, is substandard, and we've got to do something. And you and I have talked about that on a number of occasions. I strongly support that. The thing that troubles me about the latest draft is the repeal of the Frank Initiative. But I'm troubled for a different reason, through the chair. And that is because the Frank Initiative strengthens the initiative process in this state. The issue of the Capitol's location and condition is something that has a high degree of public visibility and a high degree of public interest throughout the state. The public's right to know and participate in this issue is something that a lot of people prize and treasure. And Representative Gardner brought that up a few minutes ago. To muddy the water by repealing that public protection I think, clouds the issue here. And your argument, as I understand it, Representative Roper, is that this is confusing to the public, and the cost may be much less than the bond initiative would reflect. If, in fact, that's the case, isn't the remedy more public disclosure and more public discussion rather than less? It's like Justice Douglas said on the libel issue, on the question of free speech, that the remedy in public debate is more debate, more disclosure rather than less. Isn't that correct, sir? Through the chair.
Representative Rookberg?
Well, philosophically, through the chair, Representative Groenberg, yes. On the other hand, you look at the history of the instant subject before us, we've had, I think, 10 or 11 initiatives in the 40 years of statehood. And we found ourselves in a situation where this community is does everything, and I think rightfully so, to hang on to the legislature for their own benefit, and I think that's a legitimate purpose for these folks in this community. On the other hand, I think the people of the state of Alaska have expressed their will in some of these votes, approving a new location for it historically. Additionally, as I recall, the way the Constitution of our state was drafted is up to the legislature to find its own home. And that's what my provisions provide in my bill provide for that. And they are, I believe, in conflict with the Frank Initiative statutory language. And that's why I added the repealer to it. Because this my bill allows the legislature to move forward on its own without necessarily going to the people.
Representative Groenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You've raised a constitutional issue, that the Constitution allows the legislature to choose its own home by statute. And, in fact, we've distributed the Frank Initiative here, and on the same page is AS 440610, side of Capitol. The capital of the state is the city of Juneau, Alaska, and that is the statute, and that's the legislature's right to set the statute. But the legislature, the Constitution also provides specifically that the people of the state can adopt initiatives. And in fact, they have adopted an initiative requiring the disclosure of the financial aspects of this deal. So are they not also following the Constitution in doing that?
Representative Groenberg, I think that I would like to interject a question to see if we can get to the heart of this. I think the my understanding is that the repeal of this provision addresses the dollar lease to the state, whereas a Frank Initiative would require the analysis of the total value of the land, the total cost of the buildings, even though we're not going to pay for those buildings, we're not going to pay for that land, but that would be the bondable cost of the capital. And therefore, that it appears that, I think that this is what Representative Roper was talking about, is the bondable costs of a building that we're not building actually gives us a false picture of what we're doing. And the Frank Initiative was based on us building a new capital.
Mr. Chair, if the members would look at AS 4406055, that the only thing that has to be given to the voters in a referendum under the Frank Initiative is the bondable issue. And if, in fact, there are no state bonds, then the Frank Initiative, by my reading, would not require that the voters approve it. So we should not repeal it. The question, in my mind, from what you're raising, Mr. Chair, is whether the Frank Initiative would apply to the deal. And if the Frank Initiative doesn't apply, then you don't have to repeal it. That just clouds the issue. That's my point.
No, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Rookberg.
I don't have a copy of legal opinion, but there was an Attorney General's opinion that drove this issue as to what the definition of all bondable costs were. And the way the AG's opinion came down, it's my understanding, and I apologize for not having a copy of that, is that all potential, anything that could be bonded was to be part of the dollar amount.
Ray, I read it through the chair. But that's bondable cost to the state, not the citizens of Juneau.
Well, it doesn't say that. And that's how the AG's opinion is. And that's how they got $3.8 billion in that ludicrous figure in the 82 initiative. It was because of that. They counted every possible conceivable item.
I think at this point in time, yeah. You know, we'll have another hearing. We'll get the AG's opinion, yeah. If you wouldn't mind providing that to us. So
that'll answer my
question.
Because
this is a question that that needs to be resolved to find out whether it's applicable or whether we want to entertain an amendment. Is there any other questions for the sponsor before we go to public testimony?
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Elkins.
I'm not sure it's necessary for the sponsor, but a question I have is, would we be required, regardless of the winning community, would the state be required to underwrite any of the bonds?
Mr. Chairman, not the way my particular proposal in the bill is drafted. I mean, that's one of the issues. It's given the history of and the Attorney General's opinion about how the Frank Initiative is to work. It doesn't work for my proposal. It may work under a more traditional proposal. And frankly, you can make the argument if Juneau wanted to build a new building here under the Franken issue, they'd have to have a public vote on the cost of doing it for under their proposal. I mean, how do you square that? They spent all the time, effort. Matter of fact, I served on the committee for capital planning on that local issue here in Juneau at the request of the Mayor Bethel because of my background and experience in commercial real estate development. And the cost of that proposal here, I think, under the Frank Initiative, should have gone on the ballot.
Okay, I don't see any other questions. Thank you very much, Representative Rookberg, and we'll now take public testimony. Is there anyone signed up? We have anybody signed up to testify? We do not have anyone signed up to testify. Is there anyone on teleconference to testify? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience here that wishes to testify? Seeing none, we'll close the public testimony. And on House Bill 23, is there any further discussion among the committee at this time on House Bill 23? Seeing none. Representative Gardner.
You closed public testimony for today or totally? And my concern is that this issue of repealing the Frank Initiative has not really filtered out to the public, and there may very well be people who wish to testify on it. But since the committee substitute was just brought before us today, it's not generally known.
We can reopen public testimony if there are people to testify on that aspect on
Thank
changes
you.
From the and see it because it has just come out. Representative Grimberg.
Thank you. Yes, Mr. Chair. There really are two now with the provisions repealing the Frank Initiative. There are now additional dimension to the bill and the question of whether the capital is ultimately moved under or whatever's done under the rest of the bill is a potential issue, but the repeal of the Frank Initiative is something that would occur immediately. And so I agree with Representative Gardner that there may be people who have an issue, discussion on that issue alone, regardless of the rest of the bill.
And that's why I've indicated we will have, if people want to testify on that, we'll have that. We'll also have the Attorney General's opinion from the sponsor earlier than that. And if you could provide that and any other information early to the committee so that we can circulate it, that would be helpful because some people may call my office about the applicability. And if you have a opportunity to get an opinion from Ledge Legal on the applicability of bonding to your particular provision of the $1 per year lease. That would be helpful to us all, because I think that we have a situation here where there's confusion, and what we want to do is get clarity as to what the meaning of that provision is and how it applies to your bill. And I want to correct, because it was not moving the Capitol, it was moving the legislative hall, is what this bill does.
Mr. Chair, I would request...
Representative Gruenberg?
Thank you. I would request potentially that as we review that Attorney General's opinion, the legal issue about that, that we would invite the Attorney General to send somebody to be prepared to testify at the hearing on the legal issue.
We can invite them.
Thank you.
Is there any other discussion on House Bill Committee Substitute? And for the listening audience, that is version F that we have before us now, the Committee Substitute. Seeing no other comments, then we will put aside House Bill 23 until next week. And thank you very much, Representative Roekberg. Now we'll move on to House Bill 278, Retirement Bonds. And Representative Hawker is here to join us. And appreciate it. And Representative Roekberg, if you'd like to stay, we have a seat open. Representative Gatto is excused absence, so he won't be coming back today. You're perfect. Okay. And when you come back, you're free to join us up here. Okay. Thank you. So we have a fairly thick packet here on House Bill 278. And so would you introduce your bill to us?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would you like? I believe this is the first hearing we've had.
Representative Hawker, this is the first hearing, and so appreciate your leading us through the bill.
Excuse me. In the first half of the 24th legislature, we spent an extraordinary amount of time addressing the situations involving the state's pension funds and the simple fact that today, due to any number of contributing causes, we are underfunded in the amount of money that we need to have in our funds today in order to meet our obligations to the future to employees who have performed services for the state in the past. We have an underfunded pension plan. Not unusual. Almost every public entity in America is facing similar circumstances, but the fact is, we have an obligation that we as legislators have to find some way to satisfy that obligation, pay it off at the most expedient and the least possible cost to the taxpayers of the state of Alaska. And again, if you'll allow, this discussion of what I'm presenting here is not a detailed discussion of the numbers of the pension plan. It's not a detailed discussion of actuarial liabilities, which, again, last session we went into those levels of detail in extraordinarily fine detail. This is a high-level, broad discussion of a vehicle that can allow us to pay off that liability, whatever it might be, at a substantial savings to the taxpayers of the state of Alaska. And if you'll allow me to establish a general parameter for the purpose of this discussion is that our aggregate PERS and TERS underfunding today is approximately $6 billion in net present value today. And again, we could slice and dice that and find details, but if you'll allow me the latitude of an approximation of $6 billion of debt the state of Alaska owes to its pension plans. Those plans are, it's not, when I say the state of Alaska, all the public employers that are participants in those plans owe to those plans, it's approximately $6 billion. In order to satisfy that liability, if we had the wherewithal to write a $6 billion check today, we could pay off that liability, go forward, and obviously work on other efforts to prosper our state. But, I'm afraid we just don't have a bank account sitting there with $6 billion in it to pay off that liability. Now, as we all know, it's kind of like your house payment. If you could pay off your mortgage today, you'd write one check for it, it'd be great. You could pay it off for whatever the face of your mortgage is, but as we all know, because it is over time we're going to solve these things, such that, you know, financial institutions are, we have to pay ongoing interest. So in order to pay off our $6 billion liability, what we're currently doing is we're going to have to, that obligation, that liability, accumulates essentially interest every year. That obligation, just like the mortgage on our home, and in the state of Alaska here, we use a benchmark number of approximately 8.25% for the growth factor, the sort of the interest we charge ourselves on that. And what that interest really represents is the foregone earnings that we might have achieved if we had that $6 billion in the bank today. And that's really what this bill is all about, is paying off that liability or a portion of that liability immediately and getting that money into the system to start growing. The fact that if we could put that $6 billion in the bank today, let it grow at 8%, but at the same time, if we could find a way to get that money for less than 8%, we could borrow the money for, say, 5%, the state over time would save 3% over the life of solving the debt or paying off the debt. It's very much like refinancing your home. If you've got a 10% mortgage, you can refinance it at 7. Over time, you know you're going to save a great deal of money on paying off that obligation. And that is simply what a pension obligation bond or a retirement, these are called debt pension obligation bonding. That is exactly what we're here to talk about, and that is what this bill would allow participants in the retirement plan to investigate. That is the possibility of making an immediate investment into the retirement plan, investing that money at essentially our proven rate of return, which is in excess of 8%, but acquiring that money, that obligation, instead of transferring the obligation of municipalities from the pension plan to a debt vehicle that would cost us somewhere down in the, in today's rates, in the between 5.5% and 6%. There's a spread in there that we can save the people of the state of Alaska. And quite honestly, in a hypothetical, if we were today to execute such a transaction, we have the potential, very realistic potential, of saving the taxpayers of the state of Alaska $1.5 plus billion in today's money. That's net present, that's present value dollars. That's the short of where we're headed here. We're looking to see if there's a financial device that's available on the world capital markets that we could take advantage of if we grant ourselves authority. And that's simply what I'd like to talk a little bit about here, is the pros and cons of this concept. As I said, I did have a substantial bill packet, but I'd like to just kind of parse this down for folks and say that there's a couple of things here that are particularly relevant that I'd like you to focus your thoughts on. You know, first, of course, we've got the bill. We've got a sponsor statement, and as I draw your attention briefly to the 3 points in the sponsor statement, all this bill does is it authorizes our existing municipal bond bank to consider issuing these forms of debt obligations on behalf of employers. It also extends the authority, and again, to allow the bond bank to do it both for the state municipalities. But again, I want to say it is simply extending authority to the municipal bond bank to undertake such transactions for employers, public employers. And I want to emphasize the last point there. The bill in front of us is just that. It's empty authority. It's authority to consider a possible transaction. It absolutely does not authorize any debt instruments. It does not authorize or endorse any single transaction. Again, this is very high-level authority for competent, qualified professionals to investigate the viability of transactions that may or may not be appropriate for any given public employer in the state. The next document there, and this is the one that, as you, the members of the committee, Mr. Chairman, conduct their own research and evaluation of the materials. This particular document is the Introduction to Pension Obligation Bonds, prepared by Roger Davis of ORIC. This is, in my research, this is one of the best and most succinct primers on this concept that I have found. It won't take you long to review that, but I really believe this particular document will give anyone the best, a very comprehensive understanding of what this, what the issue's all about, the pros, the cons, and the considerations that have to be considered. ORIC is a bond counsel firm, very experienced professionals who have a great deal of personal experience. They have a great deal of personal experience with these sort of transactions. And again, they've done an extremely succinct job of discussing what the, this issue. Also included then two, if you want to call it, what-if discussions from investment bankers, one from Merrill Lynch and one from UBS. Now, these are a little bit dated in that they were prepared last year when we brought the bill forward the first time, but the point is they are still fully and completely relevant in this conceptual level we're discussing the issue here. And I want to emphasize specifically, this bill is not brought forward to endorse either Merrill Lynch or UBS or any specific proposal they have on the tables. This is a bill that would allow public entities to conduct these sort of negotiations and discussions with the investment banking community, whether it be the two that we just happen to have some information from or any other investment banker anywhere in America here, to look into the details of transactions. Now, these two, but as examples, the purpose of having them here is that they provide, again, the extraordinary level of detail that you might want to graze through to see, to back up my point, that it is entirely hypothetically possible if we chose to adopt this sort of a transaction scenario for the entire $6 billion liability, we could save the taxpayers of the state of Alaska $1.5 billion today. Now, also in here is, then the last pieces here are some research papers from Standard & Poor's. Standard & Poor's, of course, is one of the bond rating agencies, debt rating agencies, public entity rating agencies. Rating agencies are extremely important in that they're we always hear about what is a company's debt rating or what's a government's debt rating or is this going to injure our debt rating, which means it's our, it's these are the guys that really come in and evaluate how financially sound an entity, and whether it be a corporation or the state of Alaska or a school district or any entity, these are the people that come in and make that determination. I think they have an extraordinary amount of credibility because these are the people that Wall Street listens to. So we've got some research papers from them that I think we'll make a couple comments on shortly here. And lastly, in the package, we have a resolution from the Alaska Municipal League asking us to grant this authority for public employers in the state of Alaska to consider these financing vehicles. And again, we're not authorizing anything, but it is only asking for authority to consider the financial vehicles. Keeping this at as high a level as possible, again, as we discussed, what a pension obligation bond does is it simply allows us to borrow money at a lower rate, invest it in our retirement funds at a higher rate, and enjoy the savings of the interest spread. It's oversimplifying of what can we consider. We could make this discussion as complicated as you would like it. We can also make it as conceptually simple as the committee would like to go. Truly, the concept is just that. It is simply borrowing at some rate less than we can invest it at and enjoying the savings. Now, I'd like to point out just a couple of paragraphs in the ORIC report that hit benchmark points that we ought to consider here. And kind of in the issue of why pension obligation bonds, I'd point to page 8 if interested in looking in the ORIC report here. And I think this just succinctly says it. In the ultimate why would you do pension obligation bonds? It is there as it quotes, in some cases, pension obligation bonds are simply better than the alternative. You know, we are $6 billion in debt. We have to find some way to get there, and I believe that just says it. This mechanism is simply better than the alternative, which is, in this case, paying directly more into the pension fund asking the employees to pay more into the pension fund, or reducing benefits, or simply sitting here and hoping that the gain on the investments is ultimately going to solve the problem. Again, this vehicle, it is a component of a solution. It's not the entire solution. And we will be able to debate the merits of, you know, this. Because what it all gets down to ultimately is, as you start to see the next page, what are the disadvantages? There's going to be challenges to this. Every choice we make has an advantage and a disadvantage. We could write a check today. We could write a check today from the earnings reserve of the actually, I probably don't have enough money in the earnings reserve of the permanent fund, but we could write a check for $6 billion out of the CBR, use up all the earnings reserve of the permanent fund, and use this year's surplus. We could write one check for that amount. We've got the money in the state of Alaska. Solve our problem here. But again, I don't see that as a viable alternative. This mechanism is then, I believe, less objectionable as a means of mitigating our cost than writing the check and taking every penny the state has off the table. Address a couple of points that you'll hear of objections to the concept of pension obligation bonds. You'll hear discussions from folks that will say that pension obligation bonds are going to injure the state's credit rating, injure what the rating agencies are going to say about the state of Alaska. What I would just ask for at this point, at the high level flyover, looking at page 13 of the ORIC report, which are some extracts from rating agency comments about this concept of using pension obligation bonds to reduce our ultimate cost of satisfying our pension obligation. And again, I won't read the page to you there, but what you'll see are the rating agencies essentially endorse this concept, that it does not. And as I said, the first sentence there, they are not generally viewed as adding to the debt burden of a state and local, quoting the agencies. We can go through, and these basically say that a properly structured, and I want to emphasize that, a properly structured transaction is endorsed and actually would potentially enhance the state's credit rating because we're taking positive, proactive steps recognized and acceptable to Wall Street to address this large unfunded obligation we have. And the very last paragraph there, the Fitch comment, and Standard & Poor's, Moody's, Fitch, Duff & Phelps, these are the rating agencies. It's kind of like the Federal Reserve. These are the gurus of debt rating. Fitch believes that pension obligation bonds, and this is the operative portion of this sentence, if used moderately and in conjunction with a prudent approach to investing the proceeds and other pension assets, can be a useful tool in asset liability management. Key point here, they can be an advantage to this. They can be a useful tool. Like any other tool, any other financial practice, it can be misused, abused, and anyone that's ever lost money investing in the stock market understands that you can lose money in a financial transaction, but likewise with prudently managed transactions, you know, competent, qualified professionals, I truly believe, is a tool that we need to put in the toolbox available to the employers of the state of Alaska as they address their pension problems. And where it really gets to each and every one of our constituents, and putting that tool in their toolbox, is that ultimately the liability for solving these pension obligations is going to have to come from the people of the state of Alaska, whether people paying school taxes to support a school district. The school district's got to meet its obligations. The only way they're getting it is raising taxes on the people of the state of Alaska. If it's the state's obligation, one way or another, it's coming out of money the state has, and that's money that one way or another we're going to have to tax someone to get it, whether it's taxing the people that provide jobs, the oil industry or resource industries, or whether ultimately, in order to meet this obligation, we're sitting here looking at having to impose an income or sales tax on the people of the state of Alaska to pay this obligation. So one way or the other, this money comes from our constituents. One way or another, the decisions we make here, it's important that we really recognize that we can save real money for our constituents by considering this option. We'll also hear, some folks will, I think, very at a high level, say there may be constitutional issues here in the state. Our Constitution has a provision that basically, you know, on the surface says the state can only borrow money for capital development projects. Not meaning a state capital, by the way, as we've just discussed that, but capital improvements. Critical point there is that, as always, the folks, and we've got at least one attorney here on the committee, you know, recognize that working with that constitutional guideline, we can structure transactions that comply with it. Now, I'm not going to justify a specific approach, and certainly the folks at Merrill Lynch in Section 4 of their presentation here address constitutional issues and a legal structuring that would comply with our Constitution. I'm not here to justify that particular approach. I'm not here to endorse any approach, but I would offer that if we grant this authority, I believe there are very competent, qualified professionals and extremely smart lawyers, investment bankers, that will be able to work with our employer entities to come up with transactions that will withstand a constitutional challenge. I think I would ask us to consider this as giving our employers and the competent professionals in the investment banking and legal world the opportunity to bring forward such propositions. Rather than I'm certainly not qualified to make a legal conclusion whether something is or is not constitutional, and as we all know, you put two lawyers in a room and you get six opinions. So again, I just ask us to not close our minds to something that has the potential of saving the taxpayers of the state of Alaska $1.5 billion+. Last thing, a challenge, and this is where the rubber hits the road on this entire issue.
Okay.
The issue that you'll hear saying is you're challenging the concept of pension bonds is risk, investment risk. You know, that is really what this entire decision in considering pension bonds is about, and that is the risk and reward trade-off. In a perfect world, again, if we had $6 billion and could write a check, we could pay off our obligation to these pension funds with zero risk. Nothing easier than writing a check and being done with it. Well, we don't have that luxury. The alternative choice is just to continue to, you know, hope markets improve and continue to pay off our unfunded liability over its 30-year amortization at what's essentially a foregone cost of 8%+. We know that's it. That's also a no-risk solution of taking this, which is the highest possible cost solution. Somewhere in there, in the middle, when you put you and we and the job here, what I want to do is empower our public employers and empower the competent, qualified professionals that they'll work with to propose specific structures that can come back, financing structures that they can take back to the appropriate legislative or authoritative body and its related executive to consider in approving a transaction where they will assess the various risks. We will look at the potential risk of return. We will look at the potential risk of the cost of financing, and somewhere on that spectrum, look and say, this is an appropriate transaction that A, saves the public real dollars, and B, is within the risk tolerance level of a public policy body. And again, the easiest thing for legislative bodies and particularly government employees to do, public employees to do, is to not make a decision that entails risk. It's sort of a characteristic of public process. That is, don't take risks. Be as risk averse as possible. Again, that's an alternative. This is a place where we really do need to have government take a lesson from the private sector, where risk is what we do. Private sector, we take measured, carefully placed, calculated risks for greater returns. In this case, this is a place where the private sector, the public sector can merge, find a risk tolerance level that the private sector can provide to the public sector that is one that we can all go back to our constituents and say very, very comfortably that it was a good risk because it will reward us with excellent savings. What that point is, I don't know. This bill is not about making that decision of what risk we will tolerate or what mechanism, specific mechanism to approach, but it is simply a bill that says to, or allows, authorizes, again, our public employers across the state and the investment banking and legal community to get together and bring us a proposal to evaluate, or bring whatever the authority is a proposal to evaluate. In quick wrap-up there, this is a device that I believe we as a legislature have take very little risk in authorizing, because the ultimate control is in the evaluation of a specific transaction. But we can't even look at the specific transaction until we as a legislative body allow people to think out of the box. And this is something that we can have before you testimony from investment bankers that have much experience in this, can talk to the details as much as you'd like. But again, I would just ask the committee one thing, that's on this issue, as well as possible, we don't really need to get bogged down in the details of any given transaction or the details of a possible transaction. What we want to do is grant authority so that, again, our public employers and these people can pursue those details ad infinitum and bring us back, or bring the authorities back, a proposal that ultimately takes care of our public employees' pension obligation and saves the people of Alaska real hard dollars today. So I certainly ask you to consider this. We're very happy to work with the committee on providing any sort of expert testimony, further analysis they'd like. But, Mr. Chairman, that's the bill that is what a pension obligation bond and what this bill is all about, sir.
Okay, and we'll get to the other presenters here on the details, I think. But what I would like to ask you is some clarification. I don't know where it is in here that says that we're allowing them to develop something and then come back to us for authorization. Doesn't this bill authorize the municipal bond bank to conduct these? I mean, they don't come back to us for authorization to issue pension a specific pension obligation bond, do they?
No, and thank you, Mr. Chairman. But it would be through the process that, whether it be a school district, a municipality, or the state of Alaska, would have to go through the public entity, the public employer, would have to go through all the processes that it needs to secure the authority to incur public debt. School district's going to have to go through its school board, its legislative process, through the its municipal process, as at the state here. This, again, grants the municipal bond bank authority to set up the structure to facilitate these transactions.
Right. I just want to clarify that, because I thought I heard you saying that they would come back to us with proposals, but really that this bill actually authorizes them to develop and go through their public process to issue pension obligation bonds.
Or to undertake such a transaction.
Yeah, okay, great. That was just a clarification.
Yes, sir. That would be
Representative Gardner and then Gruenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Representative Hawker, I have tremendous and growing respect for your own financial acumen, and I appreciate you bringing this bill forward and starting the process of educating individually the legislature and also explaining to us how we can proceed on our own to have a better understanding of this issue. And I have a pretty simple question, I think. Sometimes our obligation, our public liability for the pension system is compared to a mortgage. But if I buy a $200,000 house, I know exactly what that debt is, and I have full use of the entire value of that home during the time that I own it. Yet the pension liability is different because it's not all due right now. We don't know exactly how much it is. The amount of money that we currently hold in those accounts is adequate, in my understanding, to pay our obligations, but everything that falls due today, all the bills that come in for retirees, for their medical care, for their pensions, today, tomorrow, next year, the year after. Our problem is out into the future. Is that correct?
Thank you very much, Representative Gardner. I guess the way I would characterize what I'm hearing, as I'm hearing you frame this question and issue, our pension funds today do have, and I can't tell you the number off the top of my head, but there's a lot of money in them. I mean, we have a lot of money in the pension funds themselves. We also today have an obligation, which is at best, and that's what this actuarially determined process or actuarial process determines, is an estimate of what, so to say, in a world, if we were able to just stop everything right at this exact moment, over time to the future, we have an obligation that those funds that are there today, the cash in the bank today, must satisfy. And the calculation says that over time, and that is correct, over time, there is not enough wealth in the fund to meet the obligations that exist today. I'm not sure it's, and that is a very true statement. You know, we can use them. We could sit there, make no changes whatsoever until we get out to some point when the pot runs dry. There's no money left, and we've still got all these obligations to pay. We certainly, you know, that's an option to us. That's another no risk option. Just spend the money we've got till it's out, and then keep on. But that's an obligation that is just, you know, again, it's not an allowable option under, you know, federal pension regulation, of course. But your point, yes, we could. Not literally, we got money there, we could spend it till we're out, and then worry about the future later. Part of the problem we're getting with that is, as that pool of money in there siphons off, we earn even less. Mm-hmm. The money that's there goes down. The obligations are still out there. There's less money in that pool to earn the compound interest that is factored into meeting those total obligations. So we actually end up with a more expensive solution by doing nothing than, that's why we want to front load the money. It's just like making an early, like you use a mortgage analysis. If you make an early payment on your mortgage, you know, you make a big principal payment up front, your payment goes down, there's less to pay. Same concept here, but it's not that we're paying off but we don't have as much. We would have more money in the pot to invest, so we get a greater investment return.
I'd like to just follow up. We've got to remember, I mean, it's been a year since we've worked on the pensions, or almost a year since we were vitally involved in this, but we do need to remember that 3/4 of the money paying those obligations comes from investment earnings. And so if we don't have the money in the bank now, for every dollar we don't have in the bank now, it takes basically $4 in the future, because the whole pension plan is based on the earnings of money deposited when people are working, being put in, that investment being there. That's why underfunding the pension system is so critical, because what you're doing is you're not just underfunding a dollar, you're taking the 75% that dollar is supposed to earn to pay those obligations isn't going to be there, because it hasn't been in there earning from the present dollar to the obligation dollar. So just
okay, so that's a missed opportunity cost.
That's correct.
But my question, and the real part of the question, thank you, is why do we pay interest? I mean, you mentioned an estimate interest of 8.25%, and where does that come in? Are we already paying interest on what we don't have for the future?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner,
very
much as Representative Seaton's Chair Seaton just described, and you use the words, it is the opportunity of lost investment power. So, you know, the opportunity lost is the, what we refer to it as cost. So right. It's a colloquialism. It's not quite it's not as technically accurate as you might want to pursue, but it very much, as Representative Seaton, Chair Seaton, said there, it is the foregone ability to earn that rate of return. And all the actuarial valuations are predicated on, we put money in, and when the money's there, it makes 8%+. If the money's not there, it's not making the 8%+, and we're getting deeper in the hole every day.
And there's I might just bring to everybody's attention, there is kind of a reverse action here, and that is that if we have an obligation, basically our obligation of payments that we don't have money for, is $15.6 billion over those 25 years. And if instead of thinking that we're going to earn 8.25% and back calculating to our present dollar value, if we said, okay, we're only going to be 5%, then our current obligation, instead of being about $6 billion, would be $10 or $12 billion, because we would be calculating that we are earning less money at that 75% ratio. Is going to, the earnings are going to pay 75% of those obligations. If at 5%, you know, it would only be maybe doing 50% of okay. our future obligations. So it's a kind of, we always have to remember of what we're doing. We're back calculating at an assumed 8.25%. And I think that the presenters are going to go over some figures of what our rolling average has been as far as performance.
And actually, if I might, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hawker.
Just as a benchmark, historic benchmark here, information I received via the courtesy of Representative Roper's staff, January 10th this year, information from Tom Boutin, Department of Revenue, indicating that the 10-year average for the past, look back, 10-year return, again, you know, some years you make more, some years you make less, but the point is, you know, on looking at investments and this type of vehicle, you must look at them over time. This is not a short-term fix. It's not something that, but it works only because of the averages over time. We accept that the market has certain averages that we can validate, will validate, and can continue to achieve. But the PERS investments have averaged an 8.1% over the past 10 years. TERS was 8.2%. And as a benchmark, the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, which is extremely well managed, but I will takes a higher risk profile with their investments and has a slightly higher return yet of 8.7% over the past 10 years. You know, this is one point that we as legislators in the state of Alaska enjoy a situation, a circumstance that few other legislators enjoy anywhere in America. And that is, the state of Alaska has been wealthy, is wealthy. We have had extraordinary amounts of money to invest in the open market, in the capital markets in the world. We have developed investment structures that have been proven, that work. We have incredibly competent and qualified and successful investment management at this state. So it's something that we can't, I think, and if I was in another state doing this, we'd have to be sitting here trying to justify the 8% return hurdle. Where in the state of Alaska, I truly believe as legislators, we can rest comfortably with the assumption that an 8% return over time is extraordinarily, I mean, it is achievable, valid, and a parameter that we don't have to question in this analysis.
Representative Grimberg, did you have a question? Yes, Representative Grimberg.
Thank you. It seems analytically that one question is, should we do anything? Number two, should we do specifically these pension obligation bonds? And number three, if so, should we use the vehicle, the Alaska Municipal Bond Bank, to do that? I'm not very familiar with the Alaska Municipal Bond Bank, and so some of my questions will relate to that because I'm so ignorant on the subject. You have chosen the Municipal Bond Bank to be the issuing authority. It appears, from looking at the text of the bill itself, though, that the Municipal Bond Bank has a more limited role traditionally, and that is issuing bonds for municipalities, not for the state. This bill would significantly expand its authority, not only for the municipalities, but for the state itself. Give me the pros and cons of that, please.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I would ask on this particular level of detailed pursuit that I think it would be better answered perhaps by testimony from the folks, and I don't know if they're here today, but I believe they might be, but the folks at Merrill Lynch have given a great deal of consideration to structuring and how we can structure within the confines of our Constitution. So an element of using the municipal bond bank, so the details of a hypothetical transaction, I would direct to any one of the investment banking organizations that might propose a transaction, but conceptually, in the simplest answer, use of the municipal bond bank is part of structuring a transaction to be constitutionally acceptable. It is a facility that has a great deal of, experience, competent, qualified professionals involved in the management of that facility for issuing debt. And again, I want to emphasize, this bill is, Representative Groomberg, through the chair, you asked, should we consider, you almost implied a specific transaction again, and I want to pull back.
No, I did not.
Thank you.
I didn't mean to do that.
No transaction.
To cut to the chase, I'll save that question for the right person, and I'd ask the people who were in the room, online, on deck, wherever, to be prepared, the right person to answer that question. My next question.
Representative Groomberg, before you proceed, do we have anyone online or here from the Municipal Bond Bank? We do. Okay, so we would appreciate getting some testimony from you here in a few minutes. And so since we do have somebody from the Bond Bank, let's save those questions for them. Thank you. Go ahead.
Okay.
Representative Groomberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Your sponsor statement says, final paragraph, the bill doesn't authorize any debt instruments to be issued. But it appears to me that the text of the bill does exactly that, does it not?
Through the chair, Representative Groomberg, I'd be very happy to sit down and parse with you the wordage in the bill there. And if, in fact, it does authorize the issuance of debt, I would be very happy to modify it. But I don't believe that I don't believe there's any transaction, a specific transaction authorized. It authorizes transactions to occur.
That's
it does not authorize any specific transaction.
No, but I'm saying that the bill itself authorizes transactions to occur. You might want to take a look at the sponsor statement on that. And I'm not nitpicking here. Yeah. I'm just trying to figure out what is going on.
And Representative Groomer, do you have a follow-up? Another question?
I'll be most interested in really going into this. This is going to the next level of this whole pension debt issue. This is the first time we've ever gotten into this in this committee or any others. My third question is, you have alluded to certain constitutional issues. Traditionally, if there are constitutional issues, a bill goes to judiciary. I'm the only member of this committee that's on both, and before I would ask to have it go to judiciary, I'd like to see if we can resolve those issues here to speed this thing along. I know people are very interested in this bill. It's a very important bill, but I would ask that as you and the chair are marshaling your witnesses, that you be prepared to address any constitutional issues so this committee can see if we can handle that here to speed this thing along. Thank you.
Yep. I don't see any other questions. Thank you very much, Representative Hawker. Appreciate your presentation. And Representative Kelly has a question.
Sure. Yeah, Mr. Chairman, having swam along with both of you in this Pers-Ters River for a while, one of the things that keeps coming up, and I thought Representative Gardner's comments were right on point for what the public, as they look at this, thinks. By the way, I think, as you mentioned very appropriately, this is one tool, and I think that's very appropriate. And it does pass to the municipalities some choice in their own destiny, some level of acceptance of risk instead of some sort of a dictatorial thing from our bench saying, here's how you will do it, pick your city. But I think the mortgage example is exactly what all of us run into out in the crowd. And as you well know, this is different from a mortgage. It was no mistake for me to refinance a house if I did. that was 7.5% and refinance it on August of 2003 at 5.75. No mystery in that, no mistake in that. But we have something a little different here, and I found a few ways to add another column in this that makes sense to the homeowner that I think we're obligated to get out there because it helps folks understand it. And I just would say that's the missing piece here. You hit it right on the head. Representative Hawker's run into it time and again out there in the public, this difficulty of understanding the whole present value and future value problem here. But one of the things that I found that helps is if you took on that obligation of a mortgage, but you had things in it that were not fixed over time. For example, fuel prices were in there too, and your fuel bill doubled in the fifth year of it, and your electricity bill doubled in year whatever, and you had an uninsured risk on that house that somehow accidentally came along and swept the back bedroom downstream in the middle of it. And in other words, you were trying to predict today exactly what the future total all-in for that house was. Then instead, you'd have Representative Hawker's situation here where you're trying to estimate what the all-in cost for 30 years on that mortgage is. In our case, 25 years has been used to extinguish this one. But there are ways to approach it from that standpoint that seem to resonate with the public because it's very easy to then show relative to that mortgage and that house and the all-in cost for 30 years on that house what you would have to do today. And there's a big misunderstanding about this 8.5%. 8.5% is the number which, if out there in the invested funds, which you could then set aside for your future mortgage payments, the same thing in a bank. And you would do well if that fund did well, and you would do very poorly if the fund did poorly. So I think there's a way to meet. I think you ought to keep drilling on what you're talking about and go to a very easily constructed parallel in a mortgage situation.
Well, hopefully we'll get that with the other presenters. So
sometimes they go very deep, but what I'm talking about is kind of an overview that the public can understand that addresses where Representative Hawker is appropriately trying to go here. It's one tool, but we need to explain that question, I think. I run into it all the time. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I guess the only further question I would have, it came up a couple of times, is was the risk, if we're going to a municipal bond bank, let's say we have a municipality that wants to lower their contribution rate to PERS, and so they go and issue a, $300 million bond, and that performs poorly. Where does the state come in as far as having an obligation with that to back up that bond for that municipality that we're authorizing in the bill to go forward and issue a debt instrument?
Chair Seaton, recognizing you're providing a hypothetical here of a transaction, which, I think probably best and most accurately would be who is obligated would be determined by the terms and conditions of the bond indenture itself. And the general mechanisms utilized by the municipal bond bank, the type of bonding specific liabilities, suggest might be best and most appropriately answered by our bond bank personnel and the folks that might be off, also discussing a hypothetically specific transaction.
Sure.
The idea is that, what I want to emphasize, we're not setting up a situation and creating any new liability on the part of the state of Alaska itself. We're letting employers pursue and choose transactions.
Okay, and we'll give. I'll ask the bond bank authority that question. Representative Kelly.
Last year, in conversations, and I'm sure you had similar conversations with Tom Bertan, there was some look at the UBS, the Merrill, going out and involving the street, and then some thought that through certain mechanisms we might be able to involve the state, back to risk, but involve the state in some fashion that would probably lower the cost and increase the delta between 8.25% and some lower number, which is what this would attempt to do. Is this addressing some of what he was talking about, or have you had that conversation with him?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, excuse me, no.
Yeah.
I'm not familiar with what might have been discussed there, but in honestly, again, it's generically my observation would be, and certainly you've spent a lot of time in the capital markets, the less risk perceived on a loan, essentially from the capital markets, that the lender perceives, the lower the rate you can execute it and increase your spreads. Clearly, I would defer to the folks from that are actually in those capital markets, but I would, the less risk the lender faces, and whether if the state of Alaska was willing to step up, it's got deeper pockets than Kwikluk does, I suspect there might be a difference. But again, that's the point here. In this discussion, that sort of level of detail, although it's a very important thing to consider all these alternatives, we're looking at allowing the markets to go forward and work. As, again, capital markets are also not going to go out and do something for that doesn't make economic and financial sense, but certainly they can come back, and if they need more statutory authority or otherwise, we find a transaction, I would be very happy to consider taking further action in a future date if it results in more efficient executions.
And we will have the state here tomorrow, or at our next meeting, and I think that the point that you're making is this statute authorizes this to be the Alaska Municipal Bond Bank Authority, and is there an alternative to having the state bonding authority do it? And that the state might want to present that. I think they've talked about that, but that's, that would be an alternative or an amendment to this bill, not this bill itself, I think.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hawker. Appreciate that.
Chairman, and members of the committee, thank you. And if I may just have a concluding comment.
Sure.
You will hear that there are people inside the Department of Revenue that are unwilling to take the risk related to this sort of transaction. I would ask you, as you listen to that, that is one person's perspective who themselves, as a public policy maker, do not want to take any risk. This bill does not force those people to take any risk, but it allows all the different public employers to make their own risk determinations. So thank you very much.
And
can you join us?
Yeah, Representative Hawker, you're welcome to join us if you wish at the table up here. That's fine. Representative Ramirez had to go to another meeting, so.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And let's see, I don't have the list, but maybe we could get the Municipal Bond Bank Authority up first, because we had a few specific questions to ask.
I spent a lot of time looking at it.
And would you identify yourself for the record? Oh, I do have a list.
My name is Devin Mitchell. I'm the executive director of the Alaska Municipal Bond Bank, and as a matter of full disclosure, I'm also the debt manager and reside in the Department of Revenue.
Your name again?
Devin Mitchell.
I'm sorry. Thank
Devin.
You.
Yeah.
And, Mr. Chair, if it were beneficial to the committee, I could give you a brief summary of the bond bank, since there seems to
that,
be
that would be helpful.
A lack of understanding. The bond bank's a public corporation of the state of Alaska that was created in 1976. It was created as smaller communities in the state, and generally all communities from time to time in the state of Alaska, were penalized in the capital market because of the perception of Alaska as a third world country. There was an Alaskan penalty when you went to market, and it offered an opportunity to create a more efficient means of accessing the capital markets for Alaskan communities. The bond bank over the last 5 years has issued about $400 million worth of bonds for loans to 52 different projects. I would imagine that each one of your communities has borrowed money from the bond bank, whether it's Kaktovik for a recreational facility, Nome for a school, ADAC for a harbor, Anchorage for a performing arts center roof, Ketchikan for a hospital, and a number of other things. Kenai Peninsula, Matsu Borough, not the borough, but the communities in the borough. So it's a widely used program, and I think the reason that it was selected for inclusion in this bill is the role that the bond bank currently plays with municipal entities in helping them finance their capital needs in an efficient manner. And I should say that with those loans, those 52 loans, we estimate we've saved about $32 million for the communities through efficiencies of the bond bank. And there is a state support to the bond bank as well, which is called a moral obligation of the state of Alaska, where in the statutes that create the bond bank, there are provisions for the creation of a reserve fund. And that reserve fund is essentially the equivalent of 1 year's debt service of all of the bond bank bonds. And so we have a pooled program where if you borrow money, you're borrowing money on, when the bond bank borrows money, it issues bonds in the capital markets. It takes that money and lends it to the communities at the same rates at which we borrowed the money in the national capital markets. All the bond bank's bonds in our general obligation program, our main general obligation program, are issued on a parity basis, meaning they have the same claim on assets and revenues as other bonds in the reserve fund. So we have about a $32 million reserve fund that secures our bonds. If there was a draw on that reserve fund because one of the communities defaulted, in almost all but really one case, the reserve would fully pay for that community's debt service, and so that creates part of the credit of the bond bank. But if there were a draw on that reserve because of a community default, we would be requesting the legislature, and we're actually required by the statute to request the legislature and the governor to appropriate money to replenish that reserve. That is the moral obligation. The requirement that we request the replenishment implies that we would receive the replenishment in the moral obligation.
May I just ask one very brief question, please?
Yeah, just a second. And so the state's obligation at that point is through the legislature to replenish on a default of a bond, and those bonds are pledged by the municipality as far as their tax base and everything else.
Through the chair, yeah.
And is there any distinction between that general obligation kind of bond and the security backing that and these pension bonds that would be issued through, if they were issued through you?
Through the chair, that's a good question. And we do have another program in the bond bank, a revenue bond program, which relies on specific enterprise credit strength. And so this would maybe be more similar to that in the structure as proposed. There are some questions about the structure and whether or not the implementation of that, how that would be managed. As Representative Hawker alluded to in his testimony, there's a proposal before you that contemplates a possible use of a revenue bond structure, and there's some disagreement in the legal community. As you said, you get two attorneys in a room and they're going to have more than one opinion perhaps about whether or not that would be allowed. And so I think that there are some, at a minimum, additional issues that need to be vetted by this body to ensure that if you did pass a bill that you had the expectation that it was going to allow something to occur, that you would want to ensure that it would, in fact, be the proper structure to allow that.
Okay. And I guess, where, at what point in time does that get resolved? I mean, are you suggesting that would get resolved, that if we authorize this, that would get resolved sometime further down the line, or are you suggesting that we ought to resolve that question before we authorize issuance of those bonds?
I would suggest that it should be that issue should be resolved sooner rather than later. And so to the extent that folks believe this structure is viable, that those folks explain that position, and then if other folks believe that it is not permissible, that side is also explained. And if there is some middle ground, if you look at examples in other states, I know in Oregon they actually grappled with a similar issue. I don't know all of the nuances of it, but in the end they wound up having a constitutional amendment to allow general obligation pledges of local districts for this type of obligation, which our constitutional prohibits at this point because there's no capital project. And the difficult with revenue bonds is there's not an enterprise. It's a contractual promise to pay that that exists to the pension system if you want your participants to receive the pensions that were promised to them, you have to pay. Whether or not that can be transferred then to a bond issue is a difficult question to answer, I think, even amongst attorneys.
Okay, well, it sounds like that's a question that we will be getting some more information on, and and we would appreciate it if, as we're going down that road, you can supply us with, you know, your thoughts as well. Are you located here in Juneau?
I am, yes.
Okay, so what I'm going to ask is, unless there's a specific question of the someone on the committee, I want to get people up that are from out of town. Is there anyone on the committee that has to leave at 10 o'clock? Okay, so we will, just for everybody's knowledge, we will be extending this testimony to make sure that we can get through the people from out of town that are presenting to us. But I really appreciate, Devin, your input here, and Representative Grunberg.
I do have to leave.
You do have to leave at 10? Okay.
I'm checking. Mr. Mitchell, I would, since you've given a really good capsule of the bond bank, and since we know so little about it, do you have a paper or publication or a pamphlet or something you can get to the members of the committee that says what you are and what you do?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, yes.
I mean, yeah, in more than just a one or two pages. I mean, you know, do we have a little real knowledge of you? And secondly, on the constitutional issue, it sounds to me like, number one, there may be a constitutional issue. Number two, that you would recommend that it be resolved now rather than having to resort to us passing litigation which may be ineffective. If you believe there is a constitutional issue, I'd like to see a legal opinion on that and a draft constitutional amendment. Can you get us those, please?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I haven't heard I haven't seen a legal opinion. I've talked to various bond counsels. I work with a number of different legal firms. I have a transaction that's going to close in February. There's five communities, five bond councils, in addition to the bond council that I work with the bond bank. I work on state transactions as well, another bond council, underwriters council. So in those casual conversations, there have been a variety of opinions expressed, and that's been the extent of it. I think what you're asking is something much more formal, and would, I think, the counsel I would be relying on would be the Attorney General's office, and so I would have to.
Could you request that for us?
I could request that, yes.
Because I know that bond counsel are among the most conservative members of the bar. And, you know, it's not, you know, these, and I'm being very serious. I'm a mad dog junkyard divorce lawyer. We are at the opposite end of the scale to some extent. You know.
We'll get there. Look, we need to get the presentations by.
Just a minute here. This is not something that will ever be resolved in court. It's something that some bond counsel there will say, you can't get a rating if you're going to do this. So I want to be sure that we are on really good legal ground. This is a good concept, probably, and we need to get this information.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. And let's see. Yes, we had first signed up here. Representative Hawker,
yes,
did
sir.
You have Mark? Is that
Mark?
Okay, Mark, you're going to be the presenting, or did you have?
Just move my schedule.
And I see not signed in here, but also I do believe there's a gentleman from Merrill Lynch who had actually had some contact with in preparing this, Greg in the back there, who unfortunately is not on your sign-in list, but I think he would probably like to testify.
Okay, and as part of your presentation, did you have any particular order that you would like? I mean,
If I might, sir, if we could ask the, with respect here, as I've worked with the gentleman from Merrill Lynch, sort of preparing some of this testimony, I'd defer to these two, but if he could lead
would that
testimony.
Be okay with you? I ended deferring to the sponsor here. I know that they had worked on an issue together, so.
And particularly he has.
And you will be able to remain here after 10 o'clock, is that correct? because I will be here for, to make sure that we get it and get it on the record and have it on gavel to gavel so that the members that are not here will see your presentations. Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman?
And would you introduce yourself?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. Greg Sundberg, I'm a managing director with Merrill Lynch.
Okay, very good. Would you go ahead with your presentation here? And do we all have a booklet?
Yeah.
Make sure that we're all...
What I have, Mr. Chair, is it's not a prepared presentation, and so what I would format this as is a response to any questions you might have, and more than anything, serve as a resource. I have with me today an update of very, very similar information to what Representative Hawker included in the book that he passed out earlier. So I'll tender that up.
And just to let you know, as you go through these things, like I say, it's been a year since the committee has dealt with PERS in the detail that we may be getting into. So we may go back to some questions on terminology and where we're at. So
certainly. Here. And to beg indulgence, again, my preference would be to have a format where it is questions and answers as opposed to going through this material on a page-by-page basis. The last time that we went through this material with an individual municipal entity, it took about 2.5 hours. And I know we don't have that kind of time this morning. So there were some extremely good questions asked this morning, and we could cover some of that ground again. Or alternatively, I can give a brief opening statement, and we can proceed from there. The other information I have, just again from an education standpoint, relevant to some of the questions asked, is I have a list of the roughly 160 transactions that are categorized as pension obligation bonds that have been done throughout the United States over the past 3 years. And so, again, I will put that in the hands of staff for distribution.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
We've been given your thing today, Mr. Sundberg. And, by the way, maybe you have business cards or something. Cause
I do.
If you can pass those out. We also have been given something previously, Alaska School Districts and Municipal Governments, RETERS and PERS Liability Refinancing March 05. Do you want us to keep that too, or should we toss that?
What is the date on that?
March 05.
March 05. That was intended for a different purpose, but yes, you can keep that as well. And I'd be happy to answer questions off of any of the material.
That's great. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, first of all, I'd like to say that from the standpoint of solving a quote-unquote problem, pension obligation bonds are but one piece of the puzzle. The much harder work is the work that you've previously undertaken to solve the systemic problem. And I understand that was undertaken last year with some degree of success, that there's more work to do, and would wish you good speed in solving those issues as well, because that's what stops the bleeding in the program. What we have addressed is the liability that has increased over the years and stands at an actuarially assessed number as of the current day. Representative Gardner indicated accurately earlier that that's a number that can shift over time. There are some elements that would lead one to believe that that number is never going to go to zero. Could it diminish? Yes, it possibly could. Could it increase? Quite possibly so. The tool that we're proposing that you consider is, again, but one step in the process. What I'd like to do is for the questions that surfaced earlier to be raised again and respond to those, or for alternatively Representative Hawker to guide the discussion so that we don't have to go through a voluminous book today.
Well, I think that on your, we need to go through a couple of things just so we all understand. On page 2 there, you're using some terms, UAL, which is unamortized actuarial liability.
Correct.
And then we have in that chart, so we can understand it later, the PV of assumed future benefit costs. So that's the present value. So anyway, and we're talking about the 2004 is where we have here, right? The number that we had was the of June 2004 on from page one, the pension liability of 3.4 for PERS and 2.2 or 2.3 for TERS. And hopefully all the committee will remember that when we first started dealing with this, we had a $5.2 billion number, which was on July of 2003. This is July 2004 number as $5.6 billion. July 2005 number, just with the 8.25%, not subtracted, compounded, will be at 6.0. And by the time anything could even be passed here, July 2006 will be at $6.5 billion. Now, those numbers are not changing. Those are the same numbers, but it's just that we're a year later and we haven't had 8.25% interest on that present value deposit, and so the number is still the same. Now, there can be other changes based on mortality tables and all those things, but just on the interest rate. And I wanted to make sure that everybody understands that when people are talking about the liability we have, that the number that we're using in here of 5.6 basically is based on audited 2004, July 1st, 2004, June 30th, 2004 numbers. And we've had basically at least 2 years update, and if nothing happens until 2007, we...
This meeting will end in 2 minutes.
I don't think so. So if nothing happens as far as contributions into the system by July of 2007, that obligation is going to be $7.1 billion, and that's without any changes. That's just because of not having another year of money in the bank accumulating interest. So I just wanted to go there because...
In context, that's absolutely accurate.
Okay, good.
May I ask the chair,
yes,
what is the source of those figures, all of these figures?
Oh, these are the PERS number that we had in 2003, and this is the 2004 Mercer actuarial calculations.
So the figures that you were just giving are Mercer-based?
Those are, and based at 8.25%. Being one year further down, a future obligation, compound interest at 8.25% a year subtracted from it. So every year that we have less to subtract, it means that that obligation is larger.
Thank you.
Okay, so context, just so everybody isn't saying, well, wait a minute, that wasn't the number we heard last year or last week or something.
Certainly.
So go ahead.
So picking up on a metaphor analogy that was used earlier, which we think is a very good way to look at this, which is the mortgage metaphor, which we're all familiar with. We in the debt markets tend to be somewhat colorblind with regards to obligations. So whether they're formally called a debt obligation or whether they're called a contractual obligation, we tend not to distinguish in terms of the legal framework surrounding those. Now, that's a separate discussion from the constitutional issues and legality. This is strictly based on the cash flows. So right now, when we look at this obligation, we look at something that you're being charged in a very, very simple way.
This meeting is now over. Thank you for calling.
Someone's trying to give me a message. We look at an obligation that you're being charged 8.25% on, based on an actuarial determination of the appropriate rate that you'll need to both invest at, and there's some component of that that's going to be interest, there's some component that's going to be principal, exactly like your mortgage. And that's a rate that's necessary in order for you to compound to satisfy your future obligation of this unfunded liability. So contrast that with a world where you could, instead of compounding at 8.25%, you could compound at a rate or pay a rate equal to what your cost of borrowing those funds is. And again, looking at one obligation versus the other, whether you have a contractual obligation to make those payments on a year-over-year basis or whether you have a contractual obligation to make debt service payments, the obligation itself is in essence the same. The result is markedly different because in the bond world, at least as afforded by current markets and as indicated by Representative Hawker earlier, rate right now falls somewhere between probably 5.5% and 6.5%. So markedly lower than the actuarial yield you're being charged. The number that Representative Hawker referred to earlier, which is the present value, or those of us who are financial geeks tend to look at the world as all being current dollars as opposed to future dollars being the best measurement. So on a current dollar basis, that difference is roughly somewhere around $1 billion, $800 million to $1.2 billion. That's on the PERS component, which is currently unfunded at a level, as indicated by Mr. Chair earlier, about $3.4 billion. That, in a nutshell, is really the simple mechanics of what we're talking about here. What I'd like to do also is distinguish between the debt side or the bond side of the equation and the investment side. Not wrapped up in the bond side is the prospect of what you do with the money once you have borrowed it. And it is contingent that you, instead of just paying a payment based on an interest rate of 8.25% per year, in a bond world, it is a requirement that you actually invest the money. So one thing that you need to do from your standpoint, a due diligence standpoint, is make sure that you have a vehicle in place that you're comfortable with from an investment perspective. And by all accounts and by all observation, you in fact do have that. You certainly have something that would satisfy the requirements of the rating agencies that Representative Hawker referred to earlier, Standard & Poor's, Moody's, and Fitch, as affording a high level of confidence that you were going to have an entity that was investing in a prudent fashion. That is completely separate from the bond side, and the tool that we're proposing as a potential piece of the puzzle does not incorporate a strategy for the investment of funds or a necessary component for the investment of funds. It's completely separate.
I just had a request here. So we are going to extend this hearing, and let's take a short break so that everybody can really concentrate on what you're saying here.
That was for my request.
Is that code for caffeine?
On that.
Thank you.
So we'll take an at ease for a maximum of 5 minutes. Okay, we bring this meeting back to order, State Affairs, after our brief at ease. And we head up Greg Sundberg from Merrill Lynch, and we appreciate your letting us interrupt you, your presentation there, so that we can concentrate more on it. So thank you.
Caffeine and restroom is always a fair interruption. So trying to tackle, I think, the other primary area that I heard raised, in addition to the concept of one mortgage obligation for another mortgage obligation, which I think that's the easiest way to look at this as a construct. I think the other way that talked with a number of parties about, another easy way to look at, because this is something that each of you in your own jurisdictions has seen, and that is if you have municipal debt outstanding at a higher interest rate and the market changes and allows you to refinance it, virtually every municipal entity, I would say every municipal entity in this room is well accustomed to refinancing its debt from a higher interest rate to a lower interest rate. And what you do when that process is undertaken is that you structure a new bond issue at a lower cost that has cash flows that are on a pro rata basis proportionate to your previous payments, but in fact lower because it's at a lower interest rate. And that's another useful tool, I think, in terms of looking at the construct of using bonds versus your existing contractual obligation to make payments for an unfunded liability at 8.25%.
Representative Gruber.
I'm going to ask permission to seek permission from time to ask questions. I know that in your business, financing is a very fast-changing and evolving field. You're talking in simple terms of, quote, bonding. Are there other kinds of financing that we should be looking at allowing under this legislation other than bonding? So you don't, for example, have to underwrite new bonds every time the interest rate changes. Can you have variables or other kinds of securities you can do?
With Mr. Chair, response to Representative Gruber's question. In the construct of bonds, I'm referring to bonds in a very generic sense. So within the framework of bonds, there are a number of different structural features that you can incorporate. You can use bonds.
Let me just interrupt here. Looking at it from the point of view of a conservative bond lawyer, mm-hmm. and I don't need an answer right now. I want to be sure that the words we're using here will allow even the most conservative bond lawyer to do what you're saying. And have your people please look at that and answer that carefully. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hawker.
Excuse me there, but if I might, the language, I believe, as we've constructed this bill, does not refer to bonds per se, but it refers to borrowing on behalf of public employers.
So it's not
so
just
it
limited
is,
to bonds.
It is, the bill is constructed to provide access to the widest variety of financial instruments available on the street.
And that's correct. Clear from the intent.
That would be the intent, sir.
Thank you.
Okay. And since we're on variable and fixed for a minute, if we look at page 23 of your handout there, the Oregon approach there, would you lead us through that table on page 23 just a little bit and the implications of that?
Sure. And I will answer this. I also tender this up as a question that when Mr. Pressing attends a stand that you might ask him as well, because they were actually the party that worked with Oregon on part of their obligation. We worked with the city of Portland on their obligation as well. There are two primary debt elements that are used to fund, one being a fixed rate obligation, one being a variable rate obligation. The city of Portland decided to use a combination of fixed and variable rate debt. Historically, the cost of variable rate debt has been significantly below the cost of fixed rate debt. So whether you average it over time or whether you look at a specific point in time, cost of variable rate debt is typically lower. So in their case, this was an enhancement to try to further lower the cost of borrowing. The risk with variable rate debt, of course, is that rates spike up. In the current market, we're seeing what's commonly referred to in the press as an inverted yield curve, where short-term rates, at least in the taxable sector, are higher than longer-term rates. So you might have a short rate inside 3 months that's higher than what you have at 10 years. So clearly in that type of a market condition, you're not going to benefit by mixing short-term obligations with longer-term obligations. From a conservative standpoint, you could argue that you're a lot more certain and a lot more sure, particularly with the other uncertainties of the program, in doing a straight fixed rate program.
And are the variable rate instruments here refinanceable the same way the fixed ones are?
It's one of the it's an extremely good question, Mr. Chair. The variable rate does afford the additional benefit that it can be redeemed at virtually any point in time. So the way that variable rate instruments are structured is typically to have a redemption feature that requires as little as 1 day, but generally probably 7 days of notice. So they generally are a lot more flexible than a longer-term obligation.
And the longer-term obligations are generally recallable, refinanceable, reissuable on what kind of a time frame?
Typically, long-term obligations have a redemption provision for calling the debt back in and restructuring it that says that inside of 10 years you could advance refund those obligations, outside of 10 years, and you do that to the call date on the bonds, which would be 10 years out. Outside of 10 years, you have basically the same flexibility that you have with a variable rate obligation. So really, It's the first 10 years of the obligation that we're talking about having more flexibility attached to variable rate instruments than with fixed rate instruments.
Okay, and is there a premium charged for that?
Generally, there is a premium charged for, there can be, I shouldn't say there generally is. Market has evolved to the point where there are a lot of obligations, particularly the tax-exempt realm, where there's not a premium charged for redemption of bonds early. In the taxable world, which these obligations would be taxable, there is more often a redemption premium inside that 10 years.
Okay, thank you.
May I interrupt real quick?
Yes.
I could ask. Is there a way of making them non-taxable, tax-exempt?
We've always operated on the presumption that they are taxable obligations. There are entities in various jurisdictions in the U.S. have looked for ways to do these on a tax-exempt basis. The federal government tends to frown at it's a separation. We go in the long, long, drawn-out history of separation of state and federal powers, but generally the federal government tends to frown on ways for the state to benefit at the expense of the federal government. So the extent that you can borrow tax-exempt, reinvest taxable, federal government tends not to like that. In our way of thinking and in the foreseeable future, we see these as always taxable obligations.
May I ask
follow-up? Representative Gruenberg.
What's the difference between a taxable obligation and a non-taxable? What determines that question?
Mr. Chair, in response to Representative Gruenberg's question, and this goes back, Representative Gruenberg, to your earlier comment about the conservatism and the behavior of tax-exempt attorneys or bond attorneys, but tax exemption is associated with the investor in the obligations gaining a benefit on their federal income taxes. So in essence, they do not have to claim interest received.
No, we understand that, okay. But my question is, what is the criterion for determining whether an obligation issued by a state or local government or an entity like the bond bank authority would be tax-exempt versus non-tax-exempt? What's the bright-line criterion that the IRS uses?
There's unfortunately, the bright line that the IRS uses is encapsulated in more volumes, I think, than are up behind you on the shelf. So it varies by entity, varies by type of purpose that the monies will be applied to. But as a general rule in this instance, what we're dealing with is a situation where the federal government frowns on the ability of a local jurisdiction or a state jurisdiction to be able to borrow money at a tax-exempt rate and reinvest it at a taxable rate. There are very limited circumstances where you can do that, and would tend to be the bright line.
And I think, Representative Gruenberg, what I'd like to do is pose that question to the Municipal Bond Bank Authority so that maybe they can bring us that, you know, answer from our state's perspective.
I see Mr. Mitchell writing.
If you were he's not sure me. He's
thank you. Whoever
wanting
whoever
to be in the
answer.
Room, I don't think, but the question's coming to him. But
they're here, they're fair game.
Yeah, well, that'll be not for right now. That'll be a future question. So thanks. sorry for the interruption, but we were on to that fixed and variable for a minute. So go ahead with your...
I think the other general area that was addressed was the type of vehicle that you would use to fund a bond obligation within the state of Alaska and constitutionality. And I am not, even though others have claimed that I practice law without a license sometimes, I am not an attorney, I'm an investment banker. But the world I live in is one that intersects with bond attorneys all day long, every day. And what we try to do is we try to have a nexus where we come up with an idea and we match that to existing law as best as possible. And if there are requirements to tweak or change the law, we tweak or change the law to the extent that it is desirable on the part of the benefiting entity. We try to at all costs avoid things that would require constitutional change because that's something that is probably the most difficult to achieve. So in this instance, when we first started looking at this issue, we were looking at it on the basis of individual municipal jurisdictions, not looking at it on a statewide basis necessarily or the state specifically. We tried to identify, we immediately came to the conclusion that it would be very difficult to do this under Alaska constitutional law. That as a general obligation, which is the least expensive way of borrowing, is with a general obligation, you would run afoul of the Constitution. So again, with the idea that the benefiting entities were primarily all the jurisdictions that the representatives come together to represent, we looked at who an experienced entity would be that could serve as a conduit or as an issuing entity for these contractual obligations that these municipal entities have built up. So when Mr. Mitchell earlier referenced the municipal bond bank, I think two elements enter in. One is the track record of the municipal bond bank. They have a long history of providing funding for municipal jurisdictions. We did not address, nor have we addressed up to this point, the issue of whether the state itself could solve or address its unfunded liability through the use of the municipal bond bank. That's a question that attorneys need to wrestle with further. What we did look at was, is there a precedent for municipal entities coming individually to the municipal bond bank for the issuance of debt? And the answer is yes. So we jumped then from general obligation issues to do two different types of bond issues. And there are different types of bond issues based on the revenue stream that's used to repay the debt. One of those would be appropriation debt. So we looked at the possibility that you could structure an obligation that was subject to annual appropriation, and would that, in fact, be covered under the umbrella of a general obligation? The response we've received from a number of attorneys is no, it would not be. It would be considered to be a separate obligation, and one, in fact, that could be issued. In between that, and this, again, was more primary to the use of the municipal bond bank, is are there obligations that could be structured as contractual obligations? So to use a somewhat local example, one of the fundings that I personally was involved in several years ago was funding the FBI headquarters up in Anchorage. And the FBI building is secured by contractual payments from the GSA that flow through an intermediate entity. And that's what would be more referred to as a contract obligation as opposed to a general obligation. So we looked at that as another vehicle, and again, one that we felt would make the attorneys more comfortable looking at the constitutional restrictions and looking at the available mechanisms that might be used to secure an obligation as a means of selling debt. The other side of the coin, the one that we have to wrestle with, is once the attorneys say, yes, that is allowable under existing statute, or it's allowable with the changes incorporated into, in this case, House Bill 278, is this something we could sell into the market? Would investors buy it? Question of whether or not bond counsel would provide an opinion is separate from, is there a market for these obligations at a desirable rate? And we feel in the case of both the contract obligation model as well as the appropriation model that structurally we can get to something that has a lot of investor appeal.
So contract obligation, can you contrast, or is that the same as a revenue bond?
Very similar to a revenue bond obligation. It basically would be looking at the enterprise as being, in essence, the individual municipal entity that's coming to the bond bank. They have an accumulated contractual obligation to make payments into the pension, their pension obligation. And instead of making those payments on an annual basis into the pension fund, that funding would be provided up front by the issuance of bonds, and they would instead be making contractual payments to bondholders.
Now, you're talking about the PERS contractual obligation for the portion that the past service cost, or are you talking about the entire normal service cost and past service
cost? Past service cost.
So we're separating out the past service cost. The normal service cost would still be paid by the municipality into PERS,
direct. Correct.
Okay. Representative Grunberg?
I believe, and my recollection isn't real clear, and I was just asking Representative Hawker, didn't we just pass a bill last year that provided for some alternative kind of funding that wasn't bonding, but it's a contractual thing, and I was thinking it had to do with the virology lab or something. Didn't we? And it was in this committee we dealt with it, didn't we, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, we did. The virology lab was based on, I believe, that same principle in structured payments from the federal government. From the state?
From you.
No, from admin. The Department of Administration would be paying on a lease amount, and yeah, we'll have to review it in detail, but...
So that could be done maybe with this thing, too.
So, and by the way, we're conversing with the Devin from the Bond Bank Authority.
Devin Mitchell.
For the recording secretary, who is not happy with me.
So in other words, through the chair, we do have significant precedent in this area.
If I understand the sidebar discussions that have been taking place sort of in front of me and over my shoulder, I would conclude that, Representative Grunberg, through the chair, that the vehicle that was used was referred in our lexicon as a certificate of participation or yes. lease obligation.
Yeah, it was okay. A certificate of participation.
So lucky guess on my part.
Yeah.
But... That particular obligation, yes, does in fact bear a great resemblance to what you would be doing with what I refer to as the sort of middle ground type obligation that you could construct under 278.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Was there a follow-up on that, Representative Grimm?
Yeah, Representative Hawker and I were looking at the do you have your book there? This is just for the record, Mr. Chair. There is a provision in the Constitution that he has marked with a green tab that is the one that's causing the problem. It's Article 9, Section 8, that prohibits state debt. No state debt may be contracted unless authorized by law for capital improvements or unless authorized by law for housing loans for veterans and ratified by a majority of the qualified voters of the state who vote on the question. Just for the record, to me, it may be that this legislature should look on a policy basis at whether that provision is out of date and we need to provide the state more flexibility. That seems to me in this day and age to unnecessarily constrain the operation of state government. And I would like, Mr. Chair, to maybe have this committee consider looking into that issue.
We can take that up at an appropriate time.
Yeah.
Let's see. Anybody else have any questions at this point? Is anybody confused at this point? No. Okay, great. We're all
confused to answer and gone to my tender and incriminate me.
Go ahead and proceed.
I'm not sure that there is a lot more in terms of the questions that I heard asked. What I've tried to do is encapsulate them into several general sections. I'm not sure that there is a lot more I could add. I guess somewhat in closing, I would like to add some strength to the statement that Representative Hawker made in his excellent presentation, which was that there is a check on this entire process, and that is that anything you come up with has to go through two important stages. First of all, this bill does not circumvent or replace the existing jurisdiction's process for issuing bonds. So you are not giving blanket authorization for anyone, state or municipal entity, to rush out and issue debt without going through the same process and conservative process that each individual entity has to go through to issue bonds. All this is doing is adding the potential for you to use this tool if it is viewed as a prudent part of an overall package with regards to the balance of state obligation and municipal obligations, as well as market conditions being appropriate, as well as it being right for the individual entities that use it at the time. So it is nothing more than a tool. There is no hand on the tool at that point. There is no easier access to the tool than currently exists. So nothing changes in the checks and balance there. Second major point is that the other important step that each individual entity would have to go through in order to access the markets is a very serious review by the rating agencies. And Representative Hawker referred to this earlier and indicated a couple of quotes from rating agencies. But in general, what's happened with pension obligations, with a couple of notable exceptions, and there are always, as they say, bad apples. And the bad apples in the case of pension obligation bonds tended to be grouped during the time period when the tech market was affording outrageous returns in terms of the equity market. And entities basically didn't necessarily make the mistake with the bonds. They used the bonds as a vehicle to borrow money and then concentrate their investments in one particular market sector, which would not be prudent under any circumstances. And again, that's a separate issue from bonds. That's an investment practices issue. So if you hear bandied about examples of very, very bad experiences, those would almost exclusively be the bad experiences. Rating agencies have generally become quite comfortable with this as a tool. In fact, they've become more comfortable with the tool than entities that are trying to get along without it. They view the obligations in the same way we do, that it's a contractual obligation you have to fund on an annual basis. And their question is very similar to mine. Do you do it at 8.25% interest rate, or do you do it at a lower market rate? They do not necessarily penalize you for not using this tool, but they certainly don't penalize you for using it when it's combined with a prudent investment practice. And the key is prudent investment of proceeds.
On page 5, you have a on pension financing. You see, since 2003, we've gone from, I don't know, 73 or around 70 to 60 to less than 40. What is the reason for that, you know, fairly rapid decline in the issuance of pension financing?
70 to 60 to 40 what?
The number of refinancings. On the right-hand side, you'll see that you have the years, how many were done in 2000, 2001, and then the high was in 2003, at which there was about, maybe it's 68, I don't know, somewhere around 65 to 70, and then it's steadily declined since then. Can you give us an explanation for that decline?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure I can give you a definitive answer other than to say that much like a lot of sectors of the market, the issuance of pension obligations tends to be a somewhat what I would refer to as lumpy proposition. I think if you were going to take the 2006 number and add it to it, what we anticipate or see on the horizon for the issuance of pension obligations, you'd probably see the number spike back up again. Again, this is number of financings as opposed to dollar amount of financings. So, in fact, in 2003, I provided the entire list to you. So there's, I think, 160-plus items on there you can peruse and do your own calculations. But I'm guessing that in terms of dollar volume, you'd find that dollar volume might actually have increased over time, while number of financings might have decreased. I think it depends a lot on whether a central entity issues on behalf of a number of underlying entities or whether or not you have individual entities like counties or cities solving their own pension obligations.
Okay, so there, you don't, within this trend line, you don't know of any specific reason why that's going in that direction, I mean, going rapidly in that. You think that that will probably be in 2006 back up as far as just your knowledge of the industry?
If interest rates remain where they are, and I guess that's the other factor, and I should have mentioned it earlier, but it's the reason why these two graphs are paired. If you note, 2003, we had a very definite dip in interest rates, and then we trended up slightly from there. If we remain at or near the level of interest rates that we are experiencing right now, we would anticipate that based on the growing problem and this being more and more accepted as a good tool to address the problem, that you'll see more financings done in terms of dollar amount.
Okay. Thank you. Does anyone else have any other questions about the presentation or through his book? Okay, well, thank you very much. Sure, appreciate your
thank you.
Time.
Thank you.
And we will be probably, we've got your card here, yeah. So
there yeah, I was just going to say
additional questions that will.
As
yeah.
Time goes on, if you're in Seattle, right?
I am. Based on current politics, I'm not sure I admit to that real readily, but but I'm based in Seattle. I'm very at home in the weather up here today. I'm glad to say that on a personal basis, I'm not breaking my string of rainy days, but yes.
Because the reason is, Mr. Chair, it may be that we would want to have you on the telephone to answer further questions, and you'd be available for that.
Absolutely. We have, I think, probably five of us that are up here pretty frequently, at least every other week. We're doing a lot of work with individual municipalities as well as the DOR right now, so we're up here quite frequently.
Thank you. This has been very helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Sundberg. And now we have Mark Dressing.
Pressing. Thank you, Chairman Seaton, members of the committee. As a matter of record, my name is Mark Pressing. I work with Seattle Northwest Securities. We are underwriters of municipal bonds, and we're the leading underwriters of municipal bonds and financial advisory work in the Northwest. And as a matter of what I would like to try to do is build on the testimony that's gone before, Representative Hawker, Mr. Sundberg, and Mr. Mitchell. And I have a presentation. I'm going to skip through that. I'm going to get it to a couple of slides out of that presentation, I think, that might just add to the current to the testimony before. So as an introduction to Seattle Northwest, again, we provide two services. One is underwriting services, where we underwrite bonds, and the other is financial advisory services, and they're two distinct roles. We're financial advisors to the state of Washington, for example, and the city and borough of Juneau. We underwrite bonds on behalf of many local and state entities around the Northwest. So it's two different roles. And
question, would you explain underwriting bonds?
In underwriting bonds, what we do then is we actually buy the bonds from the issuer of the bonds and turn around and sell them to investors. Okay. And we take the risk of finding the buyers for those bonds. And so it's two different roles. But and I will state that Mr. Sundberg and I are, while we are competitors in our business, in this effort we are joining forces in that we both have an interest, we believe, in providing a framework for the state of Alaska to issue pension obligation bonds. The nature of each one of those individual obligations is going to vary, but we both feel that this would be a good tool for municipal entities to have in the state. As my background is concerned, I have 25 years of public finance experience, a substantial amount of that being in Alaska. I started my career as a CPA with KPMG in Anchorage and worked with the state of Alaska Department of Revenue as a state comptroller. In that role, I was involved in the initiation of the Alaska State Pension Investment Board in the formation, and then served as staff to the Pension Investment Board for a number of years. And I also then work in now in municipal finance and underwrite bond issues. So it's a kind of a broad experience, and that I think bear to play in this, and the experience with the ASPIB before, now the Alaska Retirement Management Board, I think, in particular. So again,
may I interrupt with a question?
Representative Grimmer.
Mr. Pressing, just so we have this very clear on the record and for ethical purposes, are you speaking us today as a financial and potential financial advisor or a potential underwriter or both?
I would say as both. We have no official role right now with the state of Alaska or with any entity. We are, however, the financial advisor to the city and borough of Juneau. So in that role with the city and borough of Juneau, we have provided them with advice on whether this is something that we think that they should want to pursue. But as far as the testimony today, it is meant to be as informational in nature, and not as any obligation that we have a work with the state or any municipal entity.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So in an effort again then to build on the testimony prior, I'll try to parse my comments down and address a couple of the things that I think that came up earlier. As far as using the bond bank as an entity for this vehicle, we think that there are some benefits to that. There are other ways to do it other than the bond bank. But we think that the bond bank could provide a broader ability for smaller municipal entities to enter the capital markets that others would not be able to. And as an example, Mr. Sundberg mentioned our experience in Oregon. We see many parallels in Alaska to our experience in Oregon. We designed, implemented, and worked through the legislative and administrative process in Oregon, the pension obligation bond program there that's been quite successful. And there are very many parallels. In their case, they formed together outside of something like the municipal bond bank and had a trustee act. In one case, the Oregon School Boards Association formed their own entity to issue bonds with a trustee. And that would be similar to if the Alaska Municipal League decided to pool municipalities together. So there are other vehicles to do this. Doing it through the bond bank is not the only way to do it, but we think it would provide a very good vehicle to do that. And especially if it were the intent of the legislature to provide some additional security for the bonds that were issued through the bond bank. And I don't think that's what's anticipated right now, but I think that it was one thing that you could add on to the legislation potentially if it were your goal to reduce the borrowing costs of the entities that issue bonds through the bond bank. For example, you could put into place a stronger ability to intercept revenues to a school district or municipality that the money goes to the bond bank to make that debt payment first. Doing that would allow an entity to put that pledge in place, and it allows investors then greater security that they're going to receive their money before the operations, and they're the first hand out, if you will, when money comes in. And this would particularly play a role in the TERS system, where the majority of the funding for school districts comes from the state. Putting an intercept in place to intercept that money first before it goes to the school districts to pay the debt service on these bonds would increase investor acceptance. And what that means is it would provide a lower interest rate on that pension obligation bond. And by doing that, having a lower interest rate and refinancing this, and I don't want to use those words like mortgage and refinancing the mortgage, but by rather than having that liability accruing at 8.25%, having it accrue at a lower rate would actually result in more of the money that you send to the school districts being put to use in education and in the classrooms. So we think that if you choose to use the bond bank, that it would be a good vehicle to add on some abilities if that's what you choose to do. We think that, of course, the stronger credit quality that you can provide, the lower the borrowing cost would be. But it is a legislative decision on how much the state wants to stand in to help the municipalities.
And do you have that? I'm not finding that specifically addressed in here. Do you have it in here on?
I believe on, let me go to, I think, 8. It's just in summary, what we're trying to do is on, slide 12. Let me see here.
I saw it at the top. It looked like there was something at the top of page 8 about it.
I apologize for the. That's the problem with trying to jump into the middle of something, I suppose.
I'm sorry for interrupting you, it's sure helpful if we can make notes and.
Well, it'd be one of the recommendations that we would have, and again, the general idea is that the more.
Oh, is that on 13? And would you look in the middle of 13? Is
yes, meaningful access. I did yes.
Would,
thank you, Senator.
Would like it expanded to cover broader intercept authority, particularly for schools? Is that where
yes.
we're?
Yes.
Okay. And so.
And this is something that you could do without really putting the state behind the debt, say for a Juneau school district or any other school districts that pool together. You wouldn't be saying that if they default, that you would step in and make that payment. But what you would be saying is that you would provide the bond bank the authority to intercept the money going to the district to make the debt payments.
Mr. Chair.
Now, the intercept the money making, I'm trying to figure out, are you talking about the PERS payment that is coming from the school district based on the contribution rate that would be?
Representative Seaton, no, we're talking about the state funding that actually goes to the school district.
Foundation formula.
To the money that the state pays to the school district to support its operations, that that a portion of that could be intercepted in between the state and the school district to make the payment on the bonds through the bond bank.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gruber.
two things, I think, in follow-up here. We have two potential types of payments coming from the state to the school districts. One is what's called the foundation formula, which is the operating expense. And the other are school debt reimbursement. Are you talking about one or the other?
The foundation, Representative Grunberg, through the chair. The foundation money. The school debt reimbursement is already dedicated to make debt payments, so that wouldn't be something that you would be able to dedicate.
So this is kind of similar, then, to the Garvey bonds.
I'm not familiar with the Garvey bond, so I wouldn't be the best one to express an opinion.
I see
on
some
that.
People nodding and some people shaking their heads.
Okay.
Let's back up for just a moment.
So
if we're talking about foundation formula money,
mm-hmm.
and are we talking about the portion of the foundation formula money that is related to the salary base of teachers that make the contribution to PERS?
It would be, Representative, it'd be through the an intercept of any of the money that let me back up. The goal would be to provide bondholders more assurance that the district is going to make their payment on the bonds. So to the extent that any money coming in from any source that's available for the operations of a district, and I use a school district as an example, a municipality could be a similar example, but to the extent you can intercept any funds before it gets to the hands of the either the school district or the municipality and send it to bondholders, provides greater assurance to the bondholders that they're going to receive their money. So I use it as an example of an option, not something I would say be advocating that you do right now, but more as something that using the bond bank as a financing vehicle may help that process a little bit more, because there are already provisions in the bond bank legislation that allow it to intercept certain funds just like that, similar to this. So it's meant to be as an example, not as a proposal for this current bill.
Well, okay, but I think that it would be helpful for us to understand the concept if it relates to, I mean, if the PERS past service costs payments from school districts are what are meant to make the payments to the bond, then, you know, we're sure not looking at dual payments here. And if we're looking at trying to intercept something, it would seem to me that we have to relate it to the past service cost obligation. Otherwise, we're going to otherwise, we'll never make it through the legislature if we're talking about taking money out of the foundation formula. So I just
is meant as an example, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Yeah. If I might.
Representative Hawker.
I appreciate the presentation here, but I think we may be focused again on the specific when it should have been a more general commentary, and that is that the debt under a borrowing, the interest on the debt will be lower if there is less risk to the lender. All that we're really discussing in this point is depending on, and it's a possibility of a way the state itself may, as a policy decision, decide to lower the risk to the lender of the money. Where they referred here to intercepting school funds, well, if we had a municipal revenue sharing program as well, that might be another source. What you're providing is a more assured repayment to the lender, and that's all this is lowering the risk to the lender, lowers the rate that they would want in return for lending us the money, and increases the ultimate savings to our public employers and ultimately the citizens of the state. So again, generically, they're just saying that there are any number of technical devices we might look at. I perhaps might argue that we're looking at in this piece of legislation at the moment, it is creating the first framework to make this happen. And as bond council, our municipalities, and our investment banking world identifies vehicles that might specifically aid in an execution, I think we would consider those. It might be best to consider those when they are specifically identified, rather than trying to create a generic catch-all that might open up or might cause some unanticipated consequences. Again, I'm doing my very best to keep this bill as simple as possible, sir. But thank you very much for your consideration.
Mr. Chairman, I would agree with those comments that all of those bells and whistles, if you will, that could enhance the credit quality of these debt instruments would lower the borrowing costs, and they could be added on at a later time. This bill would put in the framework for that, and then if there is a way later, for example, if the state wanted to consider a constitutional amendment that would allow a municipality to issue general obligation bonds to fund pension obligation bonds, that would be one more vehicle that the state could consider at a later date.
Representative Gardner has a question.
I have a quick question I hope you can answer. we've heard from yourself and from a couple other people about the benefits of this, and they, as financial planners and advisors, they would support it. Do you know of any financial planners or advisors who would be likely to advise against pension obligation bonds, and on what grounds?
Well, I think the advice against by anyone, I don't know any specific advisors. I know right now the Retirement Management Board is hearing from the state's financial advisor. I don't know what his testimony would be. But it was, as was pointed out before, within the Department of Revenue, there is an opinion that these should be entered into, if at all, very cautiously. And we would agree with that assessment. They should be entered into very cautiously. But the essentially the where they become what is very important is to analyze the risk of any financing that is undertaken. And in this case, the risk is, will you earn more than you're paying on the bonds? If you take money, borrow money, and put it into an investment vehicle, and if you do not earn at least what you're paying on those bonds, you would have been better off not doing that. The state of Oregon in 2003 conducted a statistical analysis, and they came up with the conclusion that 90%, they had a 90% probability of exceeding their bond interest rate with their investment earnings. And any investment vehicle has trade-offs, pluses and minuses. The Alaska Retirement Management Board now is currently making recommendations on what that money would be invested in, and they all have trade-offs, and they all are based on probability of earning a return based on the risk of them going up and down and not hitting the target. So the state of Oregon concluded that they had a 90% chance of being in the positive on this, and that's why the state of Oregon, and they weren't the leaders. The leaders in Oregon were the school districts and the municipalities that said, we want to do this. Initially, the state was opposed to the idea of issuing pension obligation bonds. Once other people started forming their own pools and pre-funding their pension obligation liability, the state of Oregon and the state treasurer came out and said, this is something that we think we should be able to do at the state level, and that's what led to the constitutional amendment approved by the voters by 56% in the state of Oregon. They saw it working. And that's one important point that I would like to make, is that Alaska isn't cutting new ground here, but Alaska is different than every other state. The legal framework in Alaska is different, and the administrative framework is different. Right now, we believe that there are municipalities and boroughs who could go out and access the capital market and issue pension obligation bonds. But if they were to do that, there aren't the mechanisms on the administrative side to handle that deposit of funds. And that's something that we plan on working with the Alaska Retirement Management Board, and we've begun that work, to look at the nuts and bolts of the system to make sure that the money that is put in there can be appropriately accounted for, that the entity receives the appropriate benefit for that. So there are a lot of things that still would need to be done and put in place. And I would agree with Representative Hawker's comments that this does not authorize the issuance of any debt. Each governmental entity has their own process for approving debt, whether it's a municipal entity, they would be working through their borough assembly or whatever that legislative body might be. And in the state, it would be working through the state legislature. So if the state were to do something on their liability, which we think is actually a little bit more limited than some of the municipalities and boroughs have, the state has a little bit more limited ability to do that right now. But if the state were to do that, that's something that you could address on your ability, either through a constitutional amendment or some other legislation that would allow you to do that. So I think it's important to, and I think Mr. Ritchie would say from the Alaska Municipal League, it's important to distinguish between the state's liability and what the state wants to do with its share of the liability and what the municipalities have and what they want to do. And this legislation essentially, while it may eventually be used for the state, it's mainly geared, as I believe, to allow the municipalities to work with their legislative bodies to determine whether this is an appropriate vehicle for their finances.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, great. And are you going to be around or be available by phone?
I'd be available by phone. I'm in Juneau frequently. I work in Seattle right now, but next week, I can't possibly, but our experts in Oregon and pension obligation bonds, we would have somebody available for information.
Okay. Several of us have a meeting to go to, so we're going to have to adjourn. We had one more person, John Walsh, will you be able to come back next week?
Certainly, but I wasn't prepared this week.
Oh, you weren't? Oh, okay. And we do have a letter from Kevin Ritchie in our packet, and...
Can I ask one question? Very brief.
Can you go ahead and ask your question, but if it's going to take at all a long answer,
yeah, you can
we'll
respond.
Have to.
What kind of a constitutional amendment was necessary in Oregon?
In Oregon, they had a similar procedure where they could not issue bonds for this. They could not legally, within their constitution, issue bonds.
I'd like you to elaborate on that or okay. somebody a little more in writing, please.
Right. We can provide you that information. And also, we have asked legal counsel to draft what a constitutional amendment would look
please.
Like in Alaska already. I'd be happy to work with Devin Mitchell to provide that.
Great. We'd appreciate that. And with that, we'll adjourn at 11:05.